You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at WeAreLibertarians.com.
The Boss Hog of Liberty podcast is the latest hit on the We Are Libertarians Network. Each week, Jeremiah Morrill and Dakota Davis explore life in Henry County, Indiana.
It's a show about our circle of friends, public officials, and our experiences. 80% observation, life, humor, and 20% politics. Boss Hog of Liberty is the day-to-day happenings of Henry County, Indiana, which is just like your community. Add us on iTunes and sample us today.
Dear Leader would want you to.
Oh, the Johnny Rocket Launchpad is Liberty. Each week, we strive to bring you the best guests in talk radio. The Johnny Rocket Launchpad delivers weekly interviews of noteworthy politicians, experts, and activists. The Johnny Rocket Launchpad is bringing the party to the Libertarian Party and launching ideas in your direction. Check us out at JohnnyRocketLaunchpad.com. You can hear me, Kurt Nelson, and the beautiful Heather Nixon talk about the ideas of liberty, rock and roll.
Hey guys, this is Roger Paxton, and if you're fed up with the government running every single aspect of your life, but you're not listening to the Lava Flow podcast yet, then what's wrong with you? Check us out at thelavaflow.com, or just go back to sucking up to the government. The Lava Flow podcast, striking the root every single episode.
It's time to shake up your podcast feed, folks, by subscribing to Lions of Liberty, the only libertarian variety show out there. Spend Mondays with me, Mark Clare, as I feature in-depth interviews with great names in the libertarian community and fun roundtable discussions.
Electric Liberty Land with me, Brian McWilliams, every Wednesday, your weekly dose of comedy, culture, and liberty.
And Felony Fridays with me, John Odermatt, where I expose injustice in the broken criminal justice system.
Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and at lionsofliberty.com.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. We bring you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves while putting people before political parties. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective with the goal of leaving you better informed. Please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Like us on Facebook, subscribe to our email newsletter at WeAreLibertarians.com, or subscribe on Patreon at Patreon.com/WeAreLibertarians. In exchange for supporting our program, we give you all kinds of bonus content and free stuff. Check out all the rewards there. If you are a $5 a month or more subscriber, you get a special feed in your podcatcher that gets you all kinds of bonus content. This week, it's 3 extra hours of We Are Libertarians. Mm. Can you imagine? 3 extra hours of this show.
That made my whole week.
I know. And every episode is commercial-free, a higher quality, it's CD quality. And you get to hear, like, we're at 12 minutes now.
Wow.
12 extra minutes
of
content.
Cut it right now, bonus episode.
Right. I mean, you could. You got to hear my Jordan Peterson impression, singing the Rainbow Frog. Connection.
Yeah. Jordan Peterson via Kermit the Frog.
Right.
Via
Rainbow Connection. Via Chris Spangle.
Now, this show is crowdsourced, so you can send us news with hashtag WAL News or in our Facebook group and Discord channel. We are always taking your questions and comments via email at editor@WeAreLibertarians.com. The amount of messages and emails that I'm getting has significantly increased in the last month, and I love it. I want to thank you guys for sending that to me. I promise to respond to all those emails, some of which include from 2 months ago that I've not yet gotten to, and I apologize. Please be warned that this show is raw, unedited, and authentic, so the language is sometimes strong and offensive. Now, with me today are the original co-hosts of We Are Libertarians, going back to our debut in March of 2012, March 8th, the day that will live in infamy. It was the...
Because no one will remember it.
Right. We tried for March 1st, but I couldn't record the show. I failed. It was very bad.
What did we even talk about?
I don't know. I think we just repeated the episode because we were lazy and didn't do show prep the next week.
Well, I'm sure we introduced ourselves.
Right.
It was first episode.
Yeah.
You always give pilots a pass.
Now, this episode is... So these co-hosts that I speak of...
Yeah.
Chris Galt, how are you?
I'm great, like always.
Thanks for joining us here on the show.
Ready to ruffle some feathers.
Of course. And Creighton Harrington, how are you?
I'm good. Ready to also do ornithological things.
See.
That was nice, wasn't it?
It was very good, actually. Creighton has his arms crossed. He's got his... He and I both just came from the gym.
Oh no, no, don't discount me. I got Jim shorts on.
He came from a place, a guy named Jim.
Right.
Oh, okay.
You've been working out in Jim?
No.
See, it's comments like that that make me rethink everything in my life, because I went to see my nieces yesterday. My beautiful, perfect nieces. I'm sure your children, if you're listening, are very cute. The children in your family are wonderful, but I have the most perfect nieces in history, and one of them is 4. Her name is, I won't say her name. And then one of them is almost 2, and apparently she likes to listen to the podcast.
Oh, no.
And she said, Uncle Tiss, because she can't say Chris yet. She goes, Uncle Tiss, can you stop teaching me naughty things? And I started laughing, and I look at my sister and asked her, like, did you teach her that? And she goes, no. She goes, no, it's because you gross. And then my sister said, yeah, she always requests the podcast because she likes to hear you talk. She doesn't understand what's going on. And I go, oh, I'm sorry about all those curse words. My sister goes, yeah, we had to turn off the Aziz Ansari episode, not as much for Lorelai's sake, but because I didn't want to hear about your sex life. I was like, fair, because other than Lorelai, and I said her name, other than my two nieces, I just assume those are the only time that you two have had sex. Yes, Luke says that puts her to sleep. Yeah, thank you, Luke, you dick. So we are streaming to our special group, Dear Leaders Court, and those people get to watch the show live and make comments. We have a great show tonight. We're going to... I'm excited about this week's shows. Like, I really thought that Tuesday's show was great. If you didn't listen to it, go back. These two shows are complementary to each other. We talked about the women's marches and a lot of male reaction to the women's marches and feminism a little bit. And tonight we're going to talk about some of the same. It's continuing in that vein. We're actually going to watch together, the three of us plus you, and you listeners at home can hear the BBC Channel 4 Jordan Peterson debate on the gender pay gap, campus protest, and postmodernism, which is the show. What is this woman's name? I forget.
I don't remember.
Not important.
Yeah, but
her career's over.
Probably not. She's going to become a martyr for this. Like, she's going to be the face of feminist journalism.
Not in America.
Not in America. Well,
yeah, Kathy Newman.
Nothing that happens in Britain, America cares about.
Right.
Like. True. Nothing at all.
So Jordan Peterson, if you don't know who he is, I first heard of him on the Joe Rogan podcast. He's been on 3 times, and honestly, you should go listen to those podcasts because they're incredibly intelligent and interesting podcasts. I would also recommend the Brett Weinstein and the Eric Weinstein podcast as well. Three very smart academics. And Jordan Peterson is someone who has been a clinical psychologist for several decades. He's a philosopher in many ways. He's someone who has talked a lot about archetypes, and his work resembles Joseph Campbell, if you understand what that is, the man with a thousand faces, where you have these certain archetypes throughout history, through mythology, through religion, and what does this all mean? And I love him because he blends all the things that I'm interested in into a cohesive philosophy.
And he does it with a Kermit the Frog voice.
Right, and he's Canadian, so he's super polite. He's the only Canadian I've ever liked, other than Michael J. Fox. Jordan Peterson's into evolutionary psychology, Christianity. He's basically a libertarian, politics, cultural and media criticism. I just love the guy. I think he's really an interesting person to listen to. And I think he's one of the most dangerous people on the planet today because he does talk about these divisive issues in a super polite way. And so the fact that he's not trying to provoke, like, there's this whole industry of people on the right now who are trying to counter the left's provocation. People like Gavin McInnes and Mike Cernovich and Milo Yiannopoulos, people who are offensive to be offensive in an effort to take the Overton window of freedom of speech to its far conclusion. And Jordan Peterson thinks a lot of the same things as those guys, but he does it in such a super sweet way. such a nice guy. Like, as you listen to this, you'll hear that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he's dangerous, is because you can't hang him by his offensive statements. Like Milo Yiannopoulos, you know, saying feminism is cancer, and that's the only thing that they repeat over and over and over and over and over. And so I think he's really a dangerous person because he's so thoughtful in a polite way.
Well, when you're in a debate and you get backed down into a corner, you know, sometimes you just want to lash back out because it's your only way out of that corner. But that's the wrong way to go about it.
Really, you?
And that's what
you gulp.
That's
not
what,
you.
That's what he does great. Is he says, "I know what I know. Nothing that you say is going to change what I know." So I'll just, you know, he says I choose my words very carefully. Yeah.
You were telling me, and I think he talks a lot about society and values and mm-hmm. and the cost of eroding values. And I'll play a video. I'll actually tag it on to the end of the recording because I think it's a really interesting piece of thought about values. Mittens has taken Creighton's chair. Creighton went to the bathroom, and now she's fighting him for it.
I think she's winning.
She is.
I think she's going to be on the podcast instead.
Come on, Mittens.
Move your feet, lose your seat.
So there she goes. So read that article that you were showing me.
CNN's headline?
Oh, CNN is really starting to be the Kathy Newman of America.
Cuckolding can be positive for some couples, this study says.
Wait, say that again?
That's what it says. Let me read you what this says. It says, according to this recent study, acting on these fantasies can have a large positive experience for many couples, and it's hardly a sign of weakness.
So if you don't know what cuckolding is, the word was originated in Othello. Othello was the main character in the play, and he was of African descent. And cuckolding is basically where a man of color comes into the bedchambers of a married couple, typically a white man and a white woman, and he makes sweet, passionate love, aggressive love, to the woman in front of the man. That's cuckolding. Well, and so cuck has taken, like, when we were kids, we all called each other fags. Like, that was, and it wasn't because we were trying to put gay people down. It was because men like to rank each other based on their masculinity as a way to establish dominance within the group. And they do it through teasing, and the ultimate insult was, you're not a man. And so cucking, being a cuck, has kind of taken the place of that word in the modern generation, as people feel empathy for their gay friends and family and go, I don't want to offend you. I don't want to put you down. But I still want to call my friend a cuck. I still want to call my friend less than a man.
This is journalism.
This is CNN.
I'm going to read the quote. Our erotic imaginations have the ability to turn shame lemons into delicious kink lemonade. That's what they wrote.
Right. And so this leads me to this interview with Kathy Newman on BBC Four in Britain, as he's over there promoting his new book, which is basically a book about taking care of yourself. And a lot of his audience is male, and it's kind of because of the Joe Rogan audience is where he got his start, and that's an overwhelmingly male audience, and they started watching a lot of his videos, and YouTube's overwhelmingly male. And I think his message is resonating with men for reasons that we outlined in the last episode. Men, the cultural conversation is that men are losers and they're failing society, and women are kicking ass. Meanwhile, women are saying men are shit, and we need to delete all men and all that good stuff. So I think he has struck a chord with people. Now, what you have to understand before we play this is that if you listen to Jordan Peterson's lectures, Jordan Peterson talks a lot about virtue and values. I'm tempted to kind of start out with that video that I was going to play originally, because I feel like you have to have, for this to be impactful, you have to have some understanding of Jordan Peterson and what he believes.
He has a strong sense of take charge of yourself.
Yeah.
Like, his mentality is, basically your fate is yours, kind of. Like, it's, you know, you can better yourself by, you know, taking charge of your life in these various ways. And as a result, he's also very, I mean, I would say openly hostile to different types of philosophies that are kind of against that, that kind of take the modus of agency off of the person and puts it on some sort of environment and says that, you know, you're not in control of yourself or kind of and stuff like that. So his biggest enemy that he talks about in his lectures is always postmodernism.
Right.
And by that, he basically means modern Marxism, more or less. I would say it's probably a little more nuanced than that, but if you've ever watched any of his lectures, he goes off about postmodernism a lot, and he does in this interview as well. But yeah, I mean, he's sort of like an old-fashioned kind of, you are, you know, the agent of your own success, and that kind of mentality.
Let's dive into this clip. I'll play this clip first. Because I think I was going to play it at the end, but I want to play it at the beginning because I think this is, especially a lot of our audience is male. It's about 70% male. And, I think it really speaks, a lot of truth. And the video is titled, "This Old Clip Explains How Jordan Peterson Actually Got Religious." And it's from, you can hear the full lecture. He has a podcast feed and you can hear it in the first, lecture. So this is Jordan Peterson speaking on TVO in Canada.
There's evidence throughout history that it's possible for people to be enlightened. And you'd think, since enlightenment is viewed as the medication for vulnerability and death, that everybody would be struggling as hard as they possibly could to be enlightened, if such a state exactly and precisely exists. But
you'll notice he sounds exactly like Kermit the Frog.
I mean, enlightenment is important.
If the barrier to enlightenment is the development of self-consciousness of the individual human's infinite capacity for evil, then you can be immediately convinced about why enlightenment is in such short supply. When I finished my first provisional examination of the sorts of motivations that drove people to set up concentration camps and to torture people terribly in those camps, I came to a terrible conclusion. It was a conclusion that I think in some ways was the worst thing that had ever happened to me, maybe intellectually and morally. I came to understand why it is that people depended on their group identity and their cultural identification, because that helped protect themselves from their own vulnerability. You have to believe things because you just don't know everything. So you have to believe things. They fill in the gaps. The beliefs fill in the gaps. If the beliefs are stripped from you, then your defenses against the infinite are stripped, and it's no wonder that people will defend their beliefs.
I think that's a really important point for today's society. I mean, we have identity politics is just rampant in America.
Yeah, we've been talking about it for weeks.
Yeah.
Months, maybe.
years. I mean, identity politics is people just buy into the identity politics so hard because it allows them to blame other people instead of taking care of themselves.
I thought, well, if you're too involved in defending your beliefs, you're going to be willing to kill other people in their defense. And we're so technologically powerful now that we can no longer be willing to kill other people in the defense of our own beliefs because the time for that is past. And I realized, well, if you don't stand up for your beliefs, you leave yourself bereft. You're open to the depredations of the infinite. That's equally intolerable. It seems to leave no way out. There is a way out, you know, and I think it's the way out that genuinely religious people have tried to offer humanity for thousands and thousands of years. And the way out of the conundrum posed to you by your reliance on ideological beliefs and your vulnerability in the face of the unknown is the development of a truly integrated and powerful character. And that's a individual development. And it means constant confrontation with things you don't understand and constant attempts to ensure that your character is composed of truth and solidity rather than deceit, and to make of yourself something that's built on a rock and not predicated on sand. And the thing is, it's one thing to tell people that because maybe they should take care of themselves. But I don't know if that's enough to tell people, because they don't take care of themselves that well. But it's a completely other thing to say, look, you know, every time you make a pathological moral decision, you move the world one step closer to complete annihilation. And I absolutely believe that. I think the historical evidence is crystal clear. And I also think that every time you make an appropriate moral decision and you manifest moral courage in the face of your own vulnerability, then you move the world one step farther from the brink.
So I think that's an important point, and I've kind of hit on that at several points over the last few months, and I was inspired by this clip because, to me, every time you tweet something, you are or post something on Facebook, you're contributing to the dialogue of society. I mean, the release the memo hashtag was fueled, and I know people want to say that it was fueled by Russian bots. It wasn't. There's been several studies that show that it was just conservatives driving this release the memo hashtag. And that has a force in society now. So the words that you put out into the world actually do mean something. So you have the ability to influence society in positive and negative ways. Your personal interactions on a daily basis have an impact in society. And I've thought a lot about this. You know, I was getting an Egg McMuffin the other day. And I typically don't talk to people when I'm in the drive-thru. And I thought, you know what? This woman has a nice coat. I'm going to compliment her on her coat. And when I said, hey, you have a nice coat on, her face lit up because it broke the monotony of her day. And it was just like a nice compliment. It cost me nothing. You know,
this time.
Right.
Until the next one takes it the wrong way.
Right. And likewise, anytime I constantly, you know, being a person who says a lot, Galt, back me up on this.
Yeah.
I'm good at apologizing. You
ain't getting apologies.
Right.
I'm trying to get one right now, too.
How you deal when you're dealing in the world of ideas and conversation, and my job is putting out into the world thoughts and ideas. There have been a lot of times in the past where I look back and I go, I contributed negatively to people that listen to my words and are influenced by it. And that has an impact. And what's the responsibility that I have sitting in front of a microphone? Like, I look at somebody like Milo Yiannopoulos, and I go, okay, I get the point of wanting to provoke for provocation's sake, but at the same time, what's the moral cost to not only society but also myself and the people that are impacted around me? So I think we have a real duty.
Provoking just to provoke kind of just snowballs that same mentality, that groupthink mentality.
Yeah.
And it just makes people not have to think.
And what's the end of that? What's the conclusion of that? And I think you'll see that in the Kathy Newman debate, where you have somebody who doesn't think because she's relying on groupthink and cliches.
Yep. The whole time.
And libertarians do it too.
Yeah.
All the time. And so
pretty much everyone does it.
Yeah, we're not immune to it. So, like, I think, well, they're all corrupt. Both sides are corrupt. Both sides are exactly the same. Yeah, you can argue that the end result of Republican and Democrat politics has been kind of the same conclusion, but they're not the same. There's a difference between the left and the right. There's a difference in the right. Mm-hmm. There's a difference in philosophy and outcomes within the left.
It's like
there's multiple strains.
Where are you rounding your zeros, at the tenths or the hundreds?
Right, exactly.
If you
right.
round it at the one, they're the same thing.
Right.
It's just bigger government.
I'd say the biggest difference is priorities. Maybe what they actually can get done and don't get done tends to be similar.
Right.
But at the end of the day, the left and right have very different priorities.
Sure.
I mean, that's evident in, like, what did Obama do? Like we said last time I was on here, what did Obama do with all the political capital when they won? Did they legalize marijuana? Did they do all this stuff? No, they gave another health care program.
Right.
Like, their priorities are far different from each other. But yeah, at the end of the day, what they actually get done tends to be within a very similar range of things.
Yeah, and also, what is the end result of these ideologies? And I've been reading a book called, well, there's a book, the one that I can think of is Ordinary Men, and it's about the men who went into Poland and basically executed people, the death camps. And there's another book that I've been reading about the guy who ended up running Treblinka. And his path was very simple. I mean, he was somebody who was a police officer, and he was against the Nazis, but then he had to become for the Nazis because he didn't want to get killed. He didn't want his wife to be killed because he saw how evil it was. And it's called Into That Darkness, and I'll read you a status that I posted yesterterday because I really started to think about this in terms of the Nasser case, where you see all these women who 150, probably the most prolific child molester in the 20 and 21st century, maybe of all time that we know of. He couldn't have done it alone. He couldn't have molested that many people who are of a cognizant age, who are teenage girls, and parents, Michigan State University, police, people knew, and they didn't say anything. And so I wrote Into That Darkness, An Examination of Conscience, is a book I'm halfway through. It is about the man that became the head of Treblinka. He wanted to tell his story so that others wouldn't follow his path. He goes along with the Nazis so they wouldn't kill him. He was a police officer with a normal life and ended up running a death camp. Normal, regular people made the Holocaust possible. How many adults failed women in the Nasser case? How many turned a blind eye to it as to not cause problems to protect their own interest? What injustices are we ignoring currently so that we don't rock the boat? And that is a lot of what Jordan Peterson is talking about in this message.
And that's the case for every single person. You know, Solzhenitsyn said, drawing on his Eastern Orthodox Christian background, every single person is the center of the world, a center of the world. Not the center of the world. The world's a complicated place. It can have all sorts of centers. It's hard to believe that you might be one of them, but everything about human existence is hard to believe. The fact that it's here at all is hard to believe. The nature of it's hard to believe. Everything that human beings does is so ridiculous and remarkable that it's like it's a consistently and constantly unfolding miracle. The idea that each of you might be a center of the cosmos in that infinite admixture of ridiculousness and absurdity is hardly more than one more ridiculous thing to swallow. Well, I'll summarize, I guess. I said that tragedy is a precondition for being. Being is the interplay between the finite and the infinite, and in that interplay there's tragedy, and there's no way out of that. Evil's something different. Evil's the conscious attempt to make the conditions of existence more pathological than they have to be. And it's motivated by conscious intent. The motivations arise because people pay a terrible price for their self-conscious awareness, and that awareness is their awareness of their vulnerability. And that is a terrible thing to be aware of. That vulnerability can be confronted forthrightly, accepted, and the appropriate decisions made. Alternatively, people can retreat into their own rationalistic arrogance and attempt to deceive themselves and everyone else about the nature of their own existence and about the nature of reality. That pathway leads to nothing but destruction. I think that there's good reason to assume that it's too late in our developmental course as a species for that path to be acceptable anymore, because we're too powerful. And if too many people stay on that path, we're going to do ourselves in. And so I would say, as we've become more technologically powerful, an increasing moral burden is being placed on each of us. It matters to the destiny of the cosmos whether or not you get your moral act straight. And I don't mean that in a trivial way. I believe that that's as close to an empirical fact as anything that can be demonstrated. And I also believe that's as terrifying a thing to consider as anything you could possibly imagine. And maybe it's too much to ask of people. But you know, our great religious traditions do continually remind us that inside every human being there's a spark of divinity. And that idea is a precondition for our entire system of law. There's always the possibility that it's true. And if it's true, it means that there's an infinite avenue of potential that lays open to every single person, and that the ability to transform the terrible conditions of reality into something not only acceptable but worthy of celebration actually lies within our grasp. And the alternative to that is the continual generation of a kind of hell that's so incomprehensibly awful that by any reasonable person's standards, it has to be regarded as something to avoid. That's all I have to say about that.
It's like the most...
Thanks, Forrest Gump.
I'm going to drop all this existential philosophical talk on you and see you all later.
I was going to say, like, I haven't heard that one, and that one sounds very, very existentialist.
Yeah.
That's what I love about existentialism in general, and Jordan Peterson in particular, is this idea of personal responsibility, really. I mean, he doesn't... I think a lot of his popularity is built on his, like, constant attacks of postmodernism.
Right.
If that's, like, what gets you into it and you actually pay attention, you come back because you realize this guy has actually a lot more to say than that.
Yeah.
And this idea of personal responsibility, like, all of the problems in the world, you know, though that's our responsibility to solve, and it's your responsibility to solve your problems. And that kind of stuff.
He's empowering people to take their life by your own sack and pull your bootstraps up and take care of your own life and clean your room.
Yeah.
You know, like clean your room, like literally clean your room is something he talks about on the Joe Rogan podcast. And this is something that is fundamentally libertarian. How can you have a society with people who don't take responsibility for their lives? How many of us listening who identify as libertarians, if you really start to think about your behavior, your words, your thoughts, how much of it are you blaming other people, blaming the government, blaming men, blaming women, blaming blacks or whites or, you know, your mom or somebody else for your behavior instead of going, all that's tragic. All that stuff that happened to me is tragic. The things that happened to me in childhood or the things that happened to me in college or the things that are happening to me now, those are tragic things. And it's very disappointing that this is how life has gone. But tomorrow doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
And that is why I think he's resonating with men, is that men feel disempowered and feel beaten up. And he is saying to men, there's still hope. You just have to get your act together.
Well, he says in an interview, too, that men – people are pointing out that men really like this, and I think it kind of personifies this – it plays into this narrative of men being attacked and women being the attackers, and the rise of women empowerment has been at the cost of male empowerment and all this.
Right.
This narrative of, like, the modern men, you know, women movement.
The meninist
movement. But, right. But he says in the interview itself, which I guess we're going to listen to in a little bit, but he points out that it's not just men that this resonates with. And it doesn't make sense that it would be, because all he's really saying is that your happiness or sadness is your choice.
Right.
Like, you have everything you need to be a better you.
Yeah.
You just have to put forth the effort. You have to actually try. You have to do things for yourself and don't rely on other people to do it for you. And, you know, that if whether you're a male or a female, that's, you know, that's a powerful message. It basically says that, you know, your life is in your hands.
Right.
And I think that's yes, it does seem to be that it's resonating more with men. But I don't see why maybe that's just because of like you said, the dynamics of YouTube and just who's experienced. But like, if the message right. that he has is heard by a wide swath of people, I would find it hard to believe that they would not it would not resonate with them all, unless you're like a hardcore Marxist or something. Then you just hate him because he doesn't like your political philosophy.
He's not somebody. I mean, he's somebody who has had a therapist practice. I mean, he doesn't just treat men. You know, he's treating people of all sexes. I mean, he's sitting there trying to reach out to anybody. He didn't start that talk by saying only the men should listen to this.
There's nothing discriminatory about what he's saying.
Exactly, because he's saying every single human being mm-hmm. on Earth is contributing to society, and it is your moral duty to take care of yourself and to treat others well because the fate of the cosmos depends on it. Because we have been... The Holocaust didn't happen when we had nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it wasn't an accident either.
Like, and, you know, the Holocaust happened over a period of 15 years of propaganda and people losing touch with the humanity of a segment of their society. And I talked about at the Women's March how, you know, you had from the stage these voices saying, these people are suffering, these people are suffering, and these are the people to blame. It's the Donald Trumps of the world, and all of his followers are to blame for your suffering. And if you were to go to a Tea Party rally, it's the Democrats, and these people are the cause for your suffering. And anytime anybody is trying to scapegoat somebody else, they're manipulating you. And they're trying to get you to detach from your own ability to think and to start trusting them and their message, to stop seeing the empathy of another person and to start seeing them as the enemy, because it's easier to manipulate you when you're the enemy. Libertarians do this with the government. You try at this point to have a conversation with a lot of libertarians about government employees. Well, they're all parasitic, blood-sucking, evil people. No, they're not. They're people who went to college, got a job as a teacher, and then...
They're people who got scammed by the system.
They're exactly right, because when you're 18, you don't understand life and what it means to be... And I talk to people all the time who work for the government that listen to this show, and they say, what should I do? And I say, listen, it's you probably didn't have an awareness, as you do now, of where your paycheck is coming from. Try to transition out of that. You know, try to do more good in the world. I mean, and that's a rational, thoughtful conversation that you can have with somebody that works in the military or the police. Like in Keene, they started to get Keene, New Hampshire, the Free Talk Live guys started to get people to leave the Keene police force in droves because they started talking to them like people instead of pigs. You know, and that's why I just find the confrontational style of a lot of libertarians, especially of a lot of our anarcho-capitalist black and yellow friends, to not be helpful. It doesn't work.
Well, and also, a lot of the reason people do this is it simplifies things. It simplifies the discussion. If you're trying to talk to somebody and you don't have to recognize the world as being an extremely complex place with, you know, infinite different nuances that, you know, you just can't wrap your mind around it. And that's, right. That's just, I'm just talking about like the social dynamics of the world. I'm not even talking about the world itself. It's just like human interaction is super complex, and it's much, in humans, we have to categorize things. We have to simplify things. We look for patterns. And when you do that in a social sense, you start putting people in groups. It makes it easier to talk about things, and you forget that everybody really is unique, and everybody has their own motivations, and they all came from different areas, they all came from different perspectives, and when you try and approach it from that way, it's just you get overwhelmed. Right. There's just no way that you could possibly contribute anything if you have to look at the world as it is. So right. you simplify it, and but at the same time, you get the danger that in simplifying it, you lose its essence, and you just start becoming playing identity politics.
Yeah, you get a Tommy Lauren masquerading as somebody who's intelligent, you know, because she tickles your ears. She makes you feel good. She makes you she tells you what you want to hear.
She's a pretty face.
And she has a pretty face. And so she's somebody that if you watch her Instagram or her, you know, I follow her on Instagram and I see her Snap stories and she uploads the hits that she does on Hannity. And it's just like the most simplistic, dumb BS that I've ever heard in my life. Like, she's either really a dumb person or she is knowingly playing a part like an actor to basically get a group of people who don't know any different because they've let their own sense of intelligence, morality, empathy slide so far that they have become a stereotype themselves.
They've been replaced with group thought.
And so conservatives who are supposed to be our allies in individualism have betrayed us. And libertarians, let me tell you this right now, don't do the same thing, because we have to lead the future, because the future with artificial intelligence and the expansion of technology, this is very important. It's going to completely erode the old institutions, the old order that kept us all bound together. The idea of Jeffrey Tucker and a beautiful anarchy, and we can have we can have anarchy because technology will allow for it. That's only going to happen if we allow for it. If we are teaching people that you can make it in society without government, you don't need to cling to this thing. And if you're just beating up on the left and just beating up on the right, then you're not doing humanity a service. We have to be the ones leading the way and leading by example, a life of individualism, empathy, and teaching people what it means to live in natural harmony and free markets and spontaneous order. Like, these are in peace. These are important things that we have to hold on to and not get drug into the left-right debate. And if we fail at that, then we will end up with a techno state that is not something that we necessarily want to live under. And how many of us are really, like, I'm shadow banned on Twitter. There are tweets that I tweet out that nobody sees. I am not an offensive person. I am not somebody that is provoking people. I'm preaching against that. And Twitter, because I have libertarian or I tweet certain things out, considers me
you
a threat.
Follow Ron Paul.
Right. We are demonetized on YouTube. We are obviously hurt by Facebook. But even with our big Facebook page, trying to have a rational conversation on Facebook with supposed libertarians is incredibly difficult because we don't allow for it. It's not Facebook doing that. It's us as a society can't handle a thoughtful conversation. The idea of don't talk about politics and don't talk about religion has led us to a place where we don't know how to talk about politics and religion. And these are the two of the most important things in society. And we have no ability to have those conversations because we want to put our heads in the sand. Mm-hmm. And we have to stop. We have to start engaging in thoughtful dialogue with each other. Go if you're a diehard conservative, go to a women's rally. If you're a super feminist, go to go to a Young Republicans meeting. Like, just and go with an open heart and an attitude of understanding, because living in that echo chamber, I'm talking to you, Galt. Talk to other people with an open heart.
So me and Creighton need to go to the communist rally,
right? And I think you will see a lot of people that you just go, I agree with these people. It's like the thought that Creighton, you're in college more than I've been in college this is the last 15 years, and Galt, you too. Like, the idea that universities are just perverting the minds and propagandizing the minds and turning out liberal robots, I don't think students pay enough attention in class to even be indoctrinated.
No, you're already indoctrinated by the time you're there and right. You're paid for it.
Yeah.
You're there to pander to your professor to get that A.
Right.
That's all people do there.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
you can't challenge them, the status quo.
In my experience, my collegiate experience, most of the teachers I ever had were more about people discussing than they were about preaching a specific ideology. Mm-hmm. There is maybe one professor I know that was very openly like socialist, and he like preached it kind of stuff.
Right.
But like, for the most part, that was early on. I switched to hard science, and there's like no politics in that.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure it depends on the school. There's some schools that are probably more blatantly political, maybe like a Berkeley or something. But like, even then, it seems to me that there's like this there's this silent majority, not silent majority, but there's this a large portion of the student body that doesn't necessarily agree with like the stereotypical leftist mentality. But they're not the ones that are organizing groups and going and setting up protests and stuff. It's the ones that have the cliche lefty right. kind of, you know, but when they do set up something and they bring in like a Ben Shapiro, you know, and they want the Ben Shapiro to come in and speak to the ideas that they agree with, and then the other side comes in and makes a big ruckus and it gets on the news and stuff like that. So it's hard to say. It's hard to say whether or not it is as cliche. I don't know though, because if it was so overtly leftist, then I don't think that we would have ever had any success at IUPUI setting up chapters of what are blatantly anti-leftist groups.
And lawyers.
Stone is in college. He said, I had a lot of discussions with liberal professors, and it was mostly all in good fun.
Mostly.
Yeah. I mean,
I liked talking to professors when you didn't have them in a class.
Right.
Because then they'll talk to you, they won't judge you, they won't hold it against your grade for the whole semester.
Yeah.
To constitutional law. That was the class.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, I was so excited to take constitutional law, my first law pre-law class. Like, I was ready to go. I was super excited. The Constitution, a living document. That's the title of the textbook.
Oh, yeah.
It just went downhill from there. Everything I said to have any kind of different opinion, it was always received, and then she would respond, yeah, that's debatable, and then she would continue and just completely ignore everything I said. In papers, she'd mark them down and say, and just find reasons to mark it down.
Right.
It was not a good time.
Yeah.
That happened a couple times, but that was the worst class.
I think there's a lot of it is all overblown, and I think there's a lot of commentators on both sides who like to completely overblow all the stuff.
Everything's overblown in today's society. We are the outraged generation.
It is bad, guys.
Everything that happens is the worst thing
that
could ever happen.
It's crazy.
I tweeted out, I said, and you can follow me at Chris Spangle, there needs to be more voices out there just going, things aren't really that bad. Things are actually pretty good. You know,
John Stewart put on, what was that, during the Obama administration, he put on the rally for basically level-headedness.
Right.
Because, he has a point. Like, he was trying to make a joke, but, like, the point, everybody's outraged about everything. How many times have you opened up your phone and the one of the headlines is this thing that you thought was innocuous that you've had your whole life is actually like super racist and hates women. Like everything that there is in this world, I remember one that was beards are racist. Like there was an article where if you have a beard then you're actually helping racism, and they went through their argument. It's like no one can just say that things are just things. They are what they are. Like, no one has any ulterior motive.
Usually things are what they are. Until you wake up and you open up your phone and Alex Jones is preaching about totalitarian governments and how they need to take over. That's not what they are.
Alex Jones.
He was on some kind of different drug this morning.
Alex Jones, I don't know what was up with him. He basically, on his show yesterday, said, listen, things are getting out of control out there. We need to have – basically what Trump needs to do is Trump needs to get the military, go and arrest all the heads of all the security agencies, have basically a coup d'etat, and have the military have a takeover. We need a one-party state, and then we just need to do that temporarily till we figure out what's going on, and then we need to – then we'll go back to constitutional government. And
How very Roman of him.
I go, what am I – is this –
Alex Jones?
Like, somebody needs to do a documentary on him. Like,
doppelgangered.
Because, of course, they'll give the government back to the people. Like, it's Caesar.
You can trust them.
Like, when one of the guys who has, like, led the charge for, you know, transparency and the government is taking over and blah, 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 is now crying the government needs to take over, you go, what has happened to that guy?
Yeah.
Like,
he drank too many juicy juices.
Honestly, like, how much fluoride is he getting in his... I mean, maybe fluoride's good. Like, it won't... Like, maybe we should need to give Galt some fluoride so he doesn't turn into that.
You drink too much bottled water and suddenly you're a dictator.
If you're drinking fluoride, stop the podcast right now, go to the grocery store and buy spring water. Don't stop drinking that. Your life will change.
You will be less indoctrinated. Oh,
you'll be able to think clearly and not have to live off this group mentality that's been driving our society that we're talking about, that's all fueled by fluoride, the whole thing.
I know what he's doing. It's not going to work.
Clever.
I can tie in anything.
I know.
Nice try.
So let's get to the Kathy Newman interview with Jordan Peterson. Now, we'll maybe if we get time, we'll play the Milo interview with her because it's equally as ridiculous. But I think there's this whole segment of society, and I think it's like 99% of people who are just like, all of this is ridiculous. Like, how many people are out there cuckolding? It's like I talked about last time. All these conversations are set by writers in New York City and LA and Chicago who write for these blogs, who all read Hunter S. Thompson and wanted to be Carrie Bradshaw when they grew up, and basically write for these clickbait mills That set
Bloomberg.
Art, that set art. That
set, say that, racist, you know, 97% of all alt-right.
So now, calm, stop. We're trying to, this has been a good show.
It is.
Without you doing that.
What?
You know what you're doing. So anyways, so they basically set the conversation and the rest of the world goes, wow, is everybody really out there cuckolding? No, nobody's cuckolding. They found one couple that is willing to be interviewed and admit that they're sexual freaks. Like, right, I'm sorry, you're a like, freak if you like, if you're into that.
If you can go find any fetish, and there's going to be like a handful of people in the world that are like, yeah. But like everybody else is normal.
You
people.
Got on FetLife and you found one cuckolding couple and said everybody's cuckolding.
But like, they did a study.
Right. Like my sister.
Everybody's got a study. That's another thing. It's like, oh, look, here's a study that says maybe possibly something with maybe like 690, whatever. Like no one knows how to read or interpret studies anymore. But then a journalist says, you know, maybe. And then like, holy crap.
Like my
vaccines cause autism.
My sister has lived in Boston and she loves Elizabeth Warren. So that kind of tells you she was a Bernie supporter, I think. Like that kind of tells you where her politics are. Like the first thing my niece says to me yesterday is, Donald Trump, boo. And she goes, why don't we like Donald Trump? She goes, because he lies. And I was like, you're right. He lies a lot. And she goes, that's bad. I go, I know. I can't argue with you. There's nothing good about the man. So she basically, but she, like, I was surprised. She's like, this feminist stuff's getting really out of control. Like it,
your niece said that?
No, my sister. Yeah. No.
He's
no.
bad. His feminist stuff.
All right. So let's get to the Kathy Newman interview with Jordan Peterson. This is the greatest thing I've ever – this is the greatest thing I've seen all year long, at least. Like it is so – like it perfectly encapsulates – how society feels. Like, I feel like society is Jordan Peterson, and the political media and the press is Kathy Newman, and everybody's just trying to have some common sense in their lives, and then the Kathy Newman comes along and says this, and then you just, it's like, she's every person we've ever argued with online.
Jordan Peterson's a superhero.
And then he destroys her.
And it's important.
The power of logic.
It's important to point out the reason that he destroys her isn't necessarily that he, like, he has good points and stuff, but what he does is he says in the interview he's very careful with his words. And that's one thing I like about him is that he never rambles. Every single word that comes out of the guy's mouth has a point. And like, it's on full display here. But what he does is he takes this like Chris said, there's always that argument you've ever been in is like some overly, you know, exasperated person who's trying to put words in your mouth and get you to say agree that you basically trying to control the narrative of the debate by making you sound like you've said the worst thing imaginable or that you've said something absurd. And he doesn't fall down that road because he's polite about it.
Yeah,
he's very. He
never raises his. I mean, I would have been screaming at the woman.
Yeah.
Like I watch this and I go, this is how every debate should go. I need to do better. Like I thought about my fight with Roger Paxton on we basically do a show together once a month with Mark Claire and Johnny Rocket, and we do the basically the Justice League of Libertarian Podcasters, whatever, and we do it for our subscribers. And he and I, the last episode, had like a really brutal fight, and he was a real dick. And I was like, you know, I could have not escalated it. I could have kind of backed down, and he probably would have, but like, I could have done, like, because he's just so calm and polite, and you connect with Jordan Peterson because you can tell that he is a therapist because he therapists you. Like my friend who is a social worker, and I start to get agitated, and she's like, how are you feeling? And I'm like, don't you social work me right now. You know what I mean? Like, he just keeps it calm.
Well, if that's how you feel, tell me more.
Right. And like, he puts the – he. I don't know. I mean, we'll listen to the interview. You can judge for yourself. But, like, this needs to be in every, like, PR person's class from now until the end of time.
Right.
Like, this should be studied. This is how you deal with a hostile interview. This is how you deal with a hostile debate. I mean, this is textbook good debate skills. I mean, I can't emphasize enough how the most that I think you'll get out of this is like how to deal with an overly hostile interviewer.
And we're going to pause. And
you've noticed Creighton hasn't been blowing up at me.
Yeah,
he used to go, oh, what? And now he's just like, I see what you're doing there. Yeah, it's because he's been watching this guy too much.
So we are going to pause.
Stand on the shoulders of giants.
We're not just going to play it all the way straight through. We're going to pause and give you some reaction as we play it. But let's get it started.
Peterson, you've said that men need to, quote, grow the hell up. Tell me why.
Well, because there's nothing uglier than an old infant. There's nothing good about it. People who don't grow up don't find the sort of meaning in their life that sustains them through difficult times, and they're certain to encounter difficult times. And they're left bitter and resentful and without purpose and adrift and hostile and resentful and vengeful and arrogant and deceitful and of no use to themselves and of no use to anyone else and no partner for a woman. And there's nothing in it that's good.
So you say hate speech. Hate speech. How many times do you think she says, so you're saying, in this interview? 50? 100?
A lot.
A lot. So here she goes.
I mean, that sounds pretty bad. You're saying there's a crisis of masculinity? I mean, what do you do about it?
You help people understand why it's necessary and important for them to grow up and adopt responsibility, why that isn't a shake your finger and get your act together sort of thing, why it's more like a delineation of the kind of destiny that makes life worth living. I've been telling young men, I wasn't specifically aiming this message at young men to begin with. It just kind of turned out that way.
And it's mostly, you admit, it's mostly men listening. I mean, 90% of your audience is a man.
Well, it's
right?
About 80% on YouTube, which is YouTube is a male domain primarily. So it's hard to tell how much of it is because YouTube is male and how much of it is because of what I'm saying. But, what I've been telling young men is that there's an actual reason why they need to grow up, which is that they have something to offer, you know, that people have within them this capacity to set the world straight and that's necessary to manifest in the world, and that also doing so is where you find the meaning that sustains you in life.
So what's gone wrong then?
Oh, God, all sorts of things have gone wrong. I don't think that young men are hear words of encouragement, some of them never in their entire lives, as far as I can tell. That's what they tell me. And the fact that the words that I've been speaking, the YouTube lectures that I've done and put online, for example, have had such a dramatic impact is an indication that young men are starving for this sort of message, because like, why in the world would they have to derive it from a lecture on YouTube? Now, they're not being taught that it's important to develop yourself.
But does it bother you that your audience is predominantly male? Isn't that a bit divisive?
He like literally at this point, as she's saying that, he shakes his head like, what?
She didn't even hear anything he said. And she then repeated the same question.
She's trying to lead the interview down the path of the cliche path that is, you know, That's going to hit on all the talking points that she wants to talk about.
What she really wants is a fight, because right. That's good TV.
And she wants him to basically, she wants to get him to say that having, or at least trying to defend the male, the overly male audience
right.
as being, you know, this good thing. And right. rather than him just saying that's just what it is, so she's trying to get him to be this... this voice of like male dominance,
right?
And he's and like right here, you can already kind of smell that she's saying, you know, isn't the fact that it's mostly men divisive in and of itself? Like, isn't it the fact that it's not diverse for diversity's sake bad? And right. he's clear. He knows what's about to happen. He does not let it go down that road. He right. does this the whole interview.
Yeah.
Like, he knows what she's trying to do, and he has the perfect response to prevent that from happening, and at the same time make you really think about what he's saying. It's I mean, I can't emphasize enough how great this interview is.
I mean, she also, there is a disdain in her voice for the idea that there would be an audience that is catered towards men, thus making his point, which is there is such a cultural conversation bias towards female success that it's become at the that it's come at the expense of men, to the point that men are sitting there going, nobody's ever said anything good to me. Like, who? Like, and I've had this experience with male interns, female interns that I've had over the last 15 years of my career have always been far more engaged in what they're doing, far more engaged in the work, far more motivated for their career, and better prepared for not only life but for the tasks that I give them. The top five interns have all been female that I've had. The male interns have all been lazy, unprepared, like emotionally backwards. Like I've seen this time and time again. And if you have a conversation with younger millennial men, but most millennial men and Gen Z guys, they just don't know what they're doing. Like, they have nobody's told them what to do. No. Their father didn't sit down and have a conversation with them, and it's because their dad was just as ill-prepared for life as... And so I just think there's this real need within men to have a conversation about what masculinity actually is. And if you are willing to engage in that conversation outside of the Christian church, because in the Christian church it's a big topic and it's acceptable because that's part of the Christian culture of the two gender roles. Mm-hmm. But if you're having a conversation, if you started a podcast around male success, you start with that question. Why are you catering to men and not everybody?
Is this acceptable?
Right. And that is,
it's 2018.
There's a serious backlash that I think comes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's saying that women shouldn't be successful. As we laid out in the last episode, that's really good. It's really good when women do well, because women moving into the workplace and gaining more equality has opened up entire new industries, and industries that are far more empathetic and helpful than male-dominated industries. So I think women's sensibilities bring a lot to the workplace, but you know, that kind of disdain for the boys' club, I think that's why you get a Gavin McInnes in the Proud Boys, where we're overtly male and it's a type of masculinity. That void for masculinity is filled by a Donald Trump. It's this perverse, false masculinity that I think is a real problem for society.
So you just linked the feminists as a reason that Trump got elected.
Absolutely. This kind of conversation is exactly why there's a backswing.
They literally shot themselves in the foot.
Absolutely. And
oh, yeah. I mean, but that's – everybody knows politics now is just like swings from one extreme to another.
Yeah.
I mean, Trump is like – he's a cartoon personification of all of the things that the left hates about the right, and the fact that that is – the fact that that's the case is probably due to the fact that the left hates these things about the right. Like, you know, they typecasted various normal people. Like when leftist commentators were calling Mitt Romney literally Hitler,
mm-hmm.
and then a Donald Trump shows up, like, what do you do? Like,
right.
Like, you can't call the, like, Mitt Romney is nowhere even close to a Donald Trump. He was just like, he was very much more middle of the road, but even that was too much. And like, so like, if you do that, they're like, well, if you're going to call Mitt Romney literally Hitler, then why don't you go with like the worst person from the perspective of a liberal? And that's what happened.
That's outlined in the Michael Wolff book, where essentially Steve Bannon, I mean, the binder's full of women comment in the debate, where Mitt Romney, for the sake of making him look like he hates women when he clearly doesn't, where he's trying to say, I have binders full of female names because diversity is important to me. I want inclusion. And they mock that. They take that out of context. They make him look stupid. And so Steve Bannon watches this, and Steve Bannon says, Donald, they're not going to take you seriously no matter what you say. So just say the most offensive thing you possibly can. Because nothing really matters. It doesn't really matter. And when everything stops mattering, that's when things start to get dangerous in a society. And, you know, one good economic mm-hmm. crisis and we're in a lot of trouble.
Part of the deal, when you're not desperate and you can walk away,
right.
That's when you're winning.
Right.
It's like, and I think that that's ironic. Like, you know, I tend to agree with the idea of diversity of viewpoints being important, you know.
I agree.
Like, that's how you learn that's how we grow. Like, we grow by getting these diverse range of views in our lives. And a lot of that has to do with experience. And I think the left has good faith on that. Like, they are obviously for diversity for diversity's sake, because they think a lot of what your political ideology or just your general ideology on life comes from the experiences you've had. And a lot of people's experiences based upon their race, their gender. And so they're like, you need to get these other in here to get these various viewpoints. And I completely agree that that is important in our lives. But when you're so invested in sort of like your own brand of that, that when somebody goes out there and tries to say, I also am for this, but they're not on your team, that you mock them like the way they did with Mitt Romney. It's like you've ruined it. Like, you've taken something that is good and you have ruined it for the sake of politics. And now what happens? It becomes meaningless. And now people say diversity for diversity's sake is a sin. And like, people on the right are like, I hate diversity for diversity's sake. And it's like, it is at root a good thing to have diversity of viewpoints and diversity of people and cultures. But like, when you go out there the way that the left has done in recent years, you've ruined it. And now the right reacts to that by saying diversity for diversity's sake is wrong. And that's not something that they should disagree with on the left. Like, what part of being conservative or libertarian or anything says, I am against diversity for diversity's sake? Like, that's dumb. Like, there's no part of the ideology that says it. But it's because of the past 10 to 15 years, it's been used as a weapon against the right, and they've been mocked for it.
Right. All right, let's go back to the interview.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's no more divisive than the fact that YouTube is primarily male and Tumblr is primarily female.
Well, that's pretty divisive,
female.
Isn't it?
But Tumblr is primarily female.
But you're just saying that's the way it is.
Well, I'm not saying anything.
How could
it's
you?
Just an observation that's the way it is.
That's the best line in the
There's plenty of
that's
women
one of the
that
best
are watching.
Lines in the whole interview. He's like, well, I'm not saying anything. It's just an observation about the world.
Right.
like, I'm just telling you I'm just telling you what's going on.
That's not profound.
My talks and buying my books. It's just that the majority of them happen to be men.
What's in it for the women, though?
Well, what sort of partner do you want? You want an overgrown child?
That is such a great response, because instead of going, what do you mean? Like, instead of turning it back around on her and making her clarify the question, I mean, he, again, as Creighton said, knows what she's trying to do. And so he engages with, he incentivizes her. He gives her a response, and the listener, who's thinking along the same lines, a very empathetic and incentivized response. He's appealing to her own selfish interests. And that's why I think that was such a brilliant answer. He didn't get caught up. What's in it for the women? Which is a ridiculous question in the first place. Like, if men do well, it doesn't hurt women. And that's the premise of her question, is that if men do well, it's somehow going to take from her and take from women and the people that she's fighting for. And he's saying it's not going to hurt you at all. In fact, it's going to benefit you in these ways. And he used selfishness, to quote Ayn Rand, basically. He used selfishness to appeal to her. And, I mean, he didn't win her over, but I think anybody watching went, yeah, that's a great point. And I think that was a beautiful rhetorical answer.
Yeah, because, I'm sure you've heard it as much as I have, that, like, you know, the women in current society complaining about, you know, oafish, overly toddler-like male
figures. Ask any woman about her Tinder.
Yeah.
It's abysmal. The way that men act on Tinder is disgraceful and abysmal.
Yeah.
Now, it's not all men. You know what I mean? Like, and I've noticed this trend over the last couple years, that it wasn't there as much the first couple years that I was dating after the divorce, but it is there now, where it is, oh, this is just how all men are. And, like, the last girl that I saw, I just, the chemistry wasn't there. There's nothing wrong with her. She's a great person. And I basically just, as empathetically and as gently as I could, said, I just want you to know that I don't see a long-term future. It's nothing about you. It's just a chemistry issue, and it's just not there. Oh, she went off. You know, nobody likes to be rejected, so I get it, but it was, like, there was no reward for, like, not ghosting her, even. Like, I treated her, like, with decency, and you got treated the same way you would if you ghosted her or called her a fat pig. And so there isn't that range, you just get lumped in, all men are this way, you're the exact same. Your efforts to try and, like, understand your emotions and treat me with respect and decency, that's not rewarded by women. You're just lumped in with every guy who just sends dick pics, and I think that's a mistake that women are making. And I know I sound selfish and like, oh, you want to be rewarded for dumping somebody. Well, I would like to have some acknowledgement that I wasn't being those guys. I'm making an effort, and you're not even appreciating that effort in any way.
We'd like people to act like adults.
I'm acting – exactly. I'm rewarding myself right now for acting like a grown-up, you know, and that's how far we've come is like – I acted like an adult, and nobody recognized me for it. Like,
yeah.
If the outcome's going to be the same, why would you change what you're doing?
And so that's what I think a lot of guys think. It's like, if I'm going to do this thing, I've figured out how to treat people with respect, and then I don't get any kind of respect back. Why not just be a dick? Why go through the effort and the vulnerability and the emotional expense of treating you with respect? If the same outcome and treatment is going to be if I just did it easily and ghosted you. And I think that's a two-way communication. So it's a vicious cycle where guys have it's so much in dating. And, man, it's tough dating because you are dealing with – it's on both sides. Men and women face this. When you're dating another person, you're dealing with all the mistakes of the last five people, you know, and so it's really hard sometimes, and you have to go, listen, that's not me. After my divorce, I treated, and I still sometimes project what happened in that marriage onto people that I'm dating, and I have to go, that's not fair. I need to stop that. So it's a vicious cycle, and I think everybody who's listening, male or female, just kind of has to go, even if it's not going to be the same, for my own moral benefit, for my own personal benefit, I don't want to look back on this moment and go, I did the wrong thing. I need to at least look back and say, even if I'm going to get screamed at, I'm going to be proud of the way that I handled that because I want to have self-respect. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part that a lot of people are missing. And I think men, if you're doing things that treat women with disrespect, then you have the inability to look back and find self-respect. And I think that's a really important thing to do, is do the hard thing. And I think that's something that men are failing at. They're not doing the hard things. And so they forget over time what the right thing, what the hard thing, what the moral thing is. And so they lose the ability to do it all together.
Well, that, and they can't get past their insecurities. That's mm-hmm. what Peterson's talking about.
Yep. So, and that's why I always recommend the book Mate, or I don't know if the title is now What Women Want, but it's by Jeffrey Miller with a G and Tucker Max.
You what, mate?
And the book is basically, here's how human attraction works, and here's how you can get women. And it's basically like, take care of yourself physically. Earn money, get a good job.
Be a well put together human being.
Have friends.
Like, what's in it for a woman to read that book?
That
was the question she asked.
What's in it for the women? What's in it for the women? Like, women could read the book too. And I think it's a great understanding of how humans actually are attracted to each other and what you can do. And I think that's what he's saying. Like, put yourself together. So let's go back to the interview.
Or do you want someone to contend with that's going to help you? And
so
you
you're saying
rely on.
Women have some sort of duty to sort of help fix the crisis of masculinity.
Well, it depends on what they want. No, I mean, it's exactly how I laid it out. Like, women deeply want men who are competent and powerful. And I don't mean power in that they can exert tyrannical control over others. That's not power. That's just corruption.
See, and he, again, back to Creighton's point, clarifies that because he knows I'm not going to get stuck on this through the rest of the interview.
Yeah.
Power is competence. And why in the world would you not want a competent partner? Well, I know why, actually. You can't dominate a competent partner. So if you want domination.
Want to dominate, is that what you're saying?
No, I'd say women who have had their relationships impaired with impaired, their relationships with men impaired, and who are afraid of such relationships will settle for a weak partner because they can dominate them. But it's,
and that's, I think, a really important point, kind of back to what I was saying. If you can control the situation by being aggressive and domineering, then you have less of a risk of getting hurt because you're in control. You don't have to give up as much because there's not as much risk, because if you have a partner that challenges you, male or female, I'm not, you know, but people who are controlling and domineering, male or female or trans, I'm going with three genders. I'm not doing the 67. Yeah.
You're not all inclusive? Really?
I can't get in on the hydrofluid genders.
Fluidity?
What about like
the people who identify their gender as
water?
What
about like Wolfkin and they're building, right. They're a building or something?
I just can't get, I'm sorry. I'm respectful, but I just can't get on the 970. There's one gender where you closely identify with the gender of what you think you might identify with, but you're not that gender. I don't know what that means. I just can't do it. All right.
You get to pick your pronoun.
Right. Pick your pronoun and tell me what you want, and I will abide by that. Because that's called respect, right?
I want you to call me they.
Okay, they. So that's fine. But what it comes down to is if you're, and you probably don't know you're a controlling person, but other people will go, oh, he's so controlling.
So like, is it the CNN article that we started with?
Right.
Is that controlling relationship? Is that what that leads to?
I mean, people do all sorts of weird things to be accepted.
But he's talking about a female-dominated relationship of a weak partner.
I don't think we're going that route.
I don't think he means like sexual dominance. I think he means like a relationship.
But
aren't they
the same thing?
Well, maybe, but you're kind of going into two different worlds. I think what he's talking about is a healthy relationship is between two people who are challenging each other. They are both give and take off of each other, and if there is only one person doing that and the other person is just basically like Jerry from Rick and Morty, then it's not going to be successful. Yeah, that's what he's talking
about. It's about relationships. Right. Relationships don't count sex.
Yeah, I think men have in a lot of relationships checked out. So, all right, let's get back to the interview before Galt does what Galt does.
It's a suboptimal solution.
Do you think that's what a lot of women are doing?
I think there's a substantial minority of women who do that. And I think it's very bad for them. They're very unhappy. It's very bad for their partners, although their partners get the advantage of not having to take any responsibility.
But what gives you the right to say that?
Stone Aldridge in the chat said, I'm an Apache attack helicopter. My pronouns are boom and bang. Okay.
Now that's a gender I can get behind.
Okay.
This is how women want their relationships, those women. I mean, you're making these vast generalizations.
Who's making the vast generalizations? Honestly, listen to this and go, which one of the two of them are vastly generalizing?
I'm a clinical psychologist.
Right, so you're saying you've done your research and women are unhappy.
I want to go back because he just like owns her with his credentials.
Those women. I mean, you're making these vast generalizations.
I'm a clinical psychologist.
Right, so you're saying you've done your research and women are unhappy dominating men.
I didn't say they were unhappy dominating men. I said it was a bad long-term solution.
Okay, you said it was making them miserable. Thing.
Yes, it is. And it depends on the time frame. I mean, there's intense pleasure in momentary domination. That's why people do it all the time.
Yeah.
But it's no formula for a long-term, successful long-term relationship.
That was
That's
the
reciprocal,
reference
right?
to sexual
Any
domination.
Any long-term relationship is reciprocal.
Galt.
Oh, now he
virtually
is,
by
but
definition.
Not the question before.
So,
let me put a quote to you from the book. Where you say there are whole disciplines in universities forthrightly hostile towards men. These are the areas of study dominated by the postmodern stroke neo-Marxist claim that Western culture in particular is an oppressive structure created by white men to dominate and exclude women. But then I want to put
minorities to dominate and exclude.
Okay, sure. But I want to put to you that here
in UK, I love that moment so much because so many times you see authors, they put stuff in a book, but then when they're in an interview and they're called out on that, they like kind of fold and backtrack it a little bit. He doesn't, not only does he not backtrack, he goes, minorities too.
He gives them
the rest of the
He's club. Literally giving her extra ammunition against his against,
right.
Like, wait, you didn't get the attack right. It's actually this.
Example. Let's take that as an example. The gender pay gap stands at just over 9%.
Oh, boy.
You've got women at the BBC recently saying that the broadcaster is illegally paying them less than men to do the same job. You've got only...
Now, let me say something about the BBC, because the top female presenter, as they call them, is making about $500,000. The top male presenter is Chris Evans, who's making £2.5 million, or whatever their money is now. So, and the reality is that Chris Evans, his ratings are like 5 times higher than hers, like 6 times. I mean, so he is a bigger draw of media, and in media, if you can get people to listen to you, then you are a draw, and you get paid more. Patreon.com/WeAreLibertarians. So you have a free market principle deciding who is getting paid more, and the audience is deciding that Chris Evans is more worthy of a higher salary than the female presenter. Same with Mark Wahlberg. He asked for $1.5 million to do reshoots for the Kevin Spacey movie that you know, they had to redo the shoots. Michelle Williams said, because of the Kevin Spacey thing, I'll do it for free. And they paid her scale. Now everybody's up in arms that it's some sort of racist, it's bigotry. Well, he asked for it. You said you'd do it for free. And plus, I couldn't pick Michelle Williams out of a lineup except for like the singer, the Miss America one.
Wait, is this the girl from Girls and Get Out?
No, she's from Dawson's Creek, I think.
Are you sure? I think Michelle Williams, I think, is Brian Williams' daughter.
No. That's Allison Williams.
Allison Williams. Yeah.
She's the one
who... Oh, I know you're talking about Michelle. I know you're talking about.
She's blonde.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mark Wahlberg is somebody that I know. I'll go see Dad's Club 2 or Stepdad's 2 or whatever that movie is, because I like Mark Wahlberg. I like Donnie Wahlberg better, but
you know what? You're the second person that said that to me in the past week, and I don't know how you can say that.
So
how could you not think Mark Wahlberg is the best after The Happening?
I don't know. Donnie Wahlberg is great on Blue Bloods. It's my favorite TV show. Here we go.
7 women running the top FTSE 100 companies.
Yeah.
So it seems to a lot of women that they're still being dominated and excluded, to quote your words back to you.
It does seem that way, but multivariate analysis of the pay gap indicate that it doesn't exist.
But that's just not true, is it? I mean, that 9% pay gap, that's a gap between median hourly earnings between men and women. That exists.
Yeah, but there's multiple reasons for that. One of them is gender, but it's not the only reason. Like, if you're a social scientist worth your salt, you never do a univariate analysis. Like, you say, well, women in aggregate are paid less than men. Okay, well, then we break it down by age. We break it down by occupation. We break it down by interest. We break it down by personality.
But you're saying basically it doesn't matter if women aren't getting to the top, because that's what's skewing that gender pay gap.
That's not what he said at all.
You're saying, well, that's just a fact of life. Women aren't necessarily going to get to the top.
No, I'm not saying it doesn't matter either.
You're saying
it's a fact of life. I'm saying there are multiple reasons for it.
Yeah, but those reasons, why should women put up with those reasons? Why should women be content?
I'm not saying that they should put up with it. I'm saying that the claim that the wage gap between men and women is only due to sex is wrong. And it is wrong. There's no doubt about that. The multivariate analysis have been done. So well, I can give you an example.
You keep on talking about multivariate analysis.
Let me give you an example.
I'm saying that 9% pay gap exists.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a gap between men and women. I'm not saying why it exists, but it exists. Now, if you're a woman...
I don't know if she knows what multivariate means.
No, she doesn't. It's like the clean...
right over her head.
It's like Trump and the clean bill. He doesn't know what a clean bill is. Like, basically what he's saying, which is the truth, is that, yes, women make 70% of what men do. If you put it all into aggregate and you make everybody... like, there's many different reasons. There's many different ways. But, like, as we said last week, in 147 of America's top 150 cities, women make more than men. And in New York City, it's 117% more in the millennial bracket, 120% in Dallas. So when you start to break down these statistics, you start to get different results. But that's statistics. You can make up whatever you want.
Right. The controversy over the pay gap is that there is a discrepancy. And if you put that on a headline and you don't talk about it in depth, it becomes an issue that reinforces the male versus female debate narrative within the country,
right.
and that's what she's doing here. She's literally telling him, let's ignore why and just say that it exists. Does that mean, is that good or bad?
Right.
And he's saying, well, it could be good or bad based upon why. And she doesn't want to go into the why until he actually just forces the conversation down that road.
Right.
But she doesn't want to go down that route because, yeah, if anyone who's been studying, you know, the statistics of the pay gap is that if you break it down into various reasonings, like if you look at, you know, if you ask why does this exist, and it, even if you're looking for it to be a reinforcement of like male dominance hierarchy, there's a bigotry against women, like you find out it's not actually that. It's a lot of the reason that women get paid more is by personal choice. Like women choose, they make decisions that don't result in higher paychecks or they don't result in higher paying jobs. And that's something they go into the interview and it's like, you can change that by making those decisions yourselves. There's not like there's a barrier that says because you're a woman, you can't get paid as much.
You can force women to start going into higher paying careers like lawyer, engineer, computer science. You can force them. If you want to fix the wage gap, you have to literally at the barrel of a gun, put it to a woman's head and say, you will do this because we need these statistics to be different instead of you being a nurse or a teacher or nonprofit work, which makes you satisfied. Mm-hmm. But we have to fix this problem and you can't do what you want because we need diversity.
Which he says again here in the interview, he points out that like if you put people free to make their own choices, men and women to make their own choices, they separate themselves into these different professions, and it just so happens that the professions that are predominantly women don't pay as well as the ones that are predominantly men.
Right. Women also choose to stay at home.
They choose happiness over money.
Well, they choose kids, and they have, and that's life. Another reason that women drop out of the workforce, causing the wage gap, is that women have they bear the children. And you know, my sister and I were having a conversation because my brother-in-law went to Harvard Business. And she said, despite being considering myself a feminist, I chose to stay home with my kids because I think it's healthier for my kids. And we chose a career path that allowed us to make that choice. And when career women at Harvard who were going to school found out that I was a stay-at-home mom, the conversation shut down because all of the sudden I was contributing to the patriarchy. So it isn't them allowing her the freedom of choice or what she thinks is healthy for her children or best for her and her family. It's what are you doing to contribute to the narrative?
Right. And this is a complaint that has been brought up well before this and the pay gap is that, you know, is it the woman's duty to stay home or is it to go out and have a career of her own? And, you know, it's obviously, hopefully it's about the free choice of the individual in the given matter. And
Harry stays home with Gunther. Harry is a stay-at-home dad. Gunther's almost one. And they made the choice that it was better for her, as he explained in the last episode, to stay at home while Lacey went out and worked. Like, this is what individualism does. It allows people to make choices that are best for them as opposed to what is best for a political narrative.
Right.
So let's get back to the interview.
That seems pretty unfair.
You have to say why it exists.
But do you agree that it's unfair? If you're a woman...
Not necessarily.
And on average, you're getting paid 9% less than a man. That's not fair, is it?
It depends on why it's happening. I can give you an example. Okay. There's a personality trait known as agreeableness. Agreeable people are compassionate and polite. And agreeable people get paid less than less agreeable people for the same job. Women are more agreeable than men.
Again, a vast generalization. Some women are not more agreeable than
men. Yes, that's true, but that's right. And some women get paid more than men.
So you're saying that by and large, women are too agreeable to get the pay rises they deserve.
No, I'm saying that that's one component of a multivariate equation that predicts salary.
I am somebody who is high in agreeableness and low in temperament, okay? And I get paid significantly less than a lot of my peers. Now, I think part of it is that agreeableness. Part of it is a lack of college degree and starting out in careers that paid me $17,000. And so when they ask you, what do you make? I make 17. All right, we'll pay you 20. And so it permanently stagnates it lowers your take-home income. But I have this trait. I'm an agreeable person, and I get paid less because I don't feel comfortable demanding a raise every year. So I don't want to have that argument because I want to please people. So I'm not a woman. I have a beard. I'm a very masculine man, as these two gentlemen can attest to.
Bro went to the gym before the episode.
Right.
What gets me about her is how hostile she is. She keeps telling him over and over again. She keeps telling him. And he's the expert on her show. Mm-hmm. Journalism used to be you ask the expert the questions.
Let him, yeah.
You know, the expert knows. You ask questions.
That's
but
why I think...
She just keeps telling him over and over again what he thinks.
Yeah, that's why I think Rogan has taken off and is such an influential broadcaster now, where Mel Gibson just did an interview with him. He didn't even really talk. He just wanted to get an issue out on mm-hmm. stem cells and went on Rogan. He didn't go on CNN. He went on Joe Rogan because he knows if he goes to CNN, he's going to have to talk about the Jew thing. You know, whereas Rogan's going to give him an hour where he's going to get the chance to talk about something else as opposed to trying to fit the political correct narrative. Like, what he did was wrong. Like, I'm not sticking up for him. But he shouldn't have to, like, start every interview explaining that when he wants to talk about something else.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Rogan is somebody that is why Jordan Peterson is popular is because he lets him talk. You know, so He's also introducing complexity to TV news, and I've often said that if you're watching TV news, you're having your intelligence insulted. If that is where you get the majority of your news, stop. Like, if you are depending on TV news to keep you informed, you're being propagandized. You're not being informed. And TV news does not lend itself. It gives you 3 minutes at most. This is extraordinary. This is 29 minutes long. Like, that's extraordinary.
I learned a lot from this video.
And they only talk about, like, they only yeah. go over, like, three topics in the whole thing.
Right. So it's just really not a format that lends itself to complex discussion, so everything is super simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Chris Cuomo is the poster child for TV news. He is literally an ape in a suit. Like, he is a dumb person. Like, if you want to understand how stupid, like, what is the end result of TV news? It's Chris Cuomo. It is literally somebody grunting, going, good, good, bad, bad. Like, he's just a...
Hardball.
He's literally, like, I don't know how his brother and his dad were so smart, and he is so dumb. He's literally an idiot.
It accounts for maybe 5% of the variance, something like that.
So surely
so
the
need about another 20, we need about another 18 factors, one of which is gender. And so there is prejudice, there's no doubt about that, but it accounts for a much smaller proportion of the variance in the pay gap than the radical feminists claim.
Okay, so rather than denying the pay gap exists, which is what you did at the beginning of this conversation, shouldn't you say to women, rather than being agreeable and not asking for a pay rise, go and ask for a pay rise. Make yourself disagreeable with your boss.
Oh, definitely, there's that. But I also didn't deny it existed. I denied it existed because of gender.
Okay.
See, because I'm very, very, very careful with my words.
So the pay gap exists, you accept that, but you're yes. saying... I mean, the pay gap between men and women exists. You're saying it's not because of gender, it's because women are too agreeable to ask for pay rises.
So it's one of the reasons.
Okay, one of the reasons. So why not get them to ask for a pay rise?
I've done that many, many times in my career.
And they just
counseled. Oh, they do it all the time. You can. It's so one of the things that you do as a clinical psychologist is assertiveness training. So you might say, often you treat people for anxiety. You treat them for depression. And maybe the next most common category after that would be assertiveness training. And so I've had many, many women, extraordinarily competent women in my clinical and consulting practice. And we put together strategies for their career development that involve continual pushing, competing for higher wages, and often tripled their wages within a 5-year period, teaching them how to negotiate.
That.
Of course.
So
of course.
Do you agree that you would be happy if that pay gap was eliminated completely?
It
because that's all the radical feminists are saying.
It would depend on how it was eradicated and how the disappearance of it was measured.
And you're saying if it's at the cost of men, that's a problem.
Oh, there's all sorts of things that it could be at the cost of. It could even be at the cost of women's own interests. So
because they might not be happy if they get equal pay.
No, because it might interfere with other things that are causing the pay gap that women are choosing to do.
Like having children.
Well, or choosing careers that actually happen to be paid less, which women do a lot of.
But why shouldn't women have the right to choose not to have children or the right to choose those demanding careers?
They do. They can. Yeah, that's fine.
But you're saying that makes them unhappy, by and large.
I'm saying that... No, I'm not saying that. I actually haven't said that so far.
You're
in the
saying
program.
It makes them miserable.
No, I said that what was making them miserable was having weak partners.
Totally different. That makes argument. Them miserable.
Right.
She's
I would say that
arguments.
Many women around the
her
age of, I would say between 28 and 32, have a career family crisis that they have to deal with. And I think that's partly because of the foreshortened time frame that women have to contend with. Like, women have to get the major pieces of their life put together faster than men, which is also partly why men aren't under so much pressure to grow up. So because for the typical woman, she has to have her career and family in order pretty much by the time she's 35.
And this is super offensive, right? How dare you bring biology and remind me that I'm limited by reality? Like, it's true. I mean, the majority, that's why I just think she's so, people like her and her are so outside of the realm of reality that people can't take it seriously. So when somebody says, yeah, a lot of women between 28 and 32 go, oh, clock's ticking. I'm out of my adolescent phase. I'm out of my college phase. I'm established at work. I've met somebody. Oh, and that around 28 is when I've noticed my female friends and women that I've been around, they all kind of settle down. Like, it's between 26 and 28 where they all kind of are done going out to the bars and drinking, and they've kind of settled into their job and they have their life figured out. And then by 32, like, they're ready to, if they haven't had kids, they're ready to have kids. Like, their job's figured out. And I've got several friends who are 25, and one friend, she's like, I just don't want to go out to the bar anymore. I go, I know. It's because you're growing up. It's called adulthood. That's what happens. And then the next thing is you're going to meet a guy, you're going to get married, and you're going to have kids. She's like, I don't want kids, but I do want to get married. I'm like, you wait. You just wait. So it's biology. It's not a broad generalization. It's just
an observation.
It's an observation. It's kind of what happens. Like, does that mean that, well, that's not how it was in my case? Like, okay, well, you're an exception. It's called individualism. Like, not everybody's the same. But by and large, I've noticed that in my female friends, and there's probably a lot of female listeners right now shaking their head going, yeah, that's about right. About 28 to 32, I really felt like I got my stuff together and I was ready to have kids. And she's like, how dare you limit me?
The average age for marriage is like 26 for a woman and 29 for a man.
Right. I didn't get my life and career figured out till 32. I'm 34. Okay? Like, I didn't get self-confidence and really feel like a grown-up until 33. And
you had to get kicked in the nuts really hard.
Really hard. I've had to learn a lot of really hard lessons to figure a lot of stuff out because I'm really thick-headed. And I'm the type of person that has to experience things to learn them. I wish I didn't have to experience some of the things to learn them, but that's how it is. Like, and I don't know that there's an age in a lot of my guy friends where they really kind of got that figured out on average, but with there's a biological pressure with women, and not every woman makes that choice, but not every woman fits this pattern. And the idea that biology plays a role in a woman's life has become offensive somehow. Like, what he just said to a large group of women is very offensive, and that doesn't make any sense to me. It's the people on the left, their denial of biology in so many different situations in an effort to make everybody feel good is the same kind of science denying that I see on the right when it comes to climate change.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
You know, like, we can't deny science. Like, there's just some realities. You can say, you can have some cognitive dissonance and say, I understand the reality of this, but I choose to ignore that and do this. Like, at least that's intellectually honest.
Theory, you know?
Right. Instead of
I
making
up theories.
I understand
the world's round, but
Creighton's smiling like, oh, this guy's career is over.
He might be on a turtle.
Huh? No, I'm...
All right, here we go.
I'm smirking in agreement.
Because otherwise the options start to run out. And so that puts a tremendous amount of stress on women, especially at the end of their 20s.
I think I take issue with the idea of the typical woman, because, you know, all women are different. And that's what I want to just put another quote to you from the book.
Well,
you
they're
say,
different in some ways and the same in others.
Okay, you say women become more vulnerable when they have children.
Oh, yes.
And you talked in one of your YouTube interviews about crazy harpy sisters. So, simple question. Is gender equality a myth in your view? Is that something that's just never going to happen?
It depends on what you mean by equality.
No, being treated if you mean fairly, men and women getting the same opportunities.
Fairly. We could get to a point where people were treated fairly or more fairly. I mean, people are treated pretty fairly in Western culture already, but we can
improve. They're really
that.
Not, though, are they? I mean, otherwise, why would there only be seven women running FTSE 100 companies in the UK? Why would there still be a pay gap, which we've discussed
at length?
Why are women at the BBC saying that they're getting paid illegally less than men to do the same job?
Let's go to the first question. Those are complicated questions. Seven women, repeat that one.
There's seven women running the top FTSE 100 companies in the UK. Okay.
Well, the first question might be, why would you want to do that?
Why would a man want to do it?
Gotcha.
Well, there's a lot of money. It's an interesting job.
There's a certain
number
of men, although...
There is a logical... I don't know what the logical fallacy... Maybe you know it. Too low quo. It's basically whataboutism. It's the logical fallacy of, well, what about blah, blah, blah? And it's always said in that tone. Blah, 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 blah. Like... She just is riddled with straw men and just every logical fallacy.
When I was watching this interview, right about a couple of minutes in, I kind of recognized that she was playing a part.
Right.
And I didn't get all huffed and puffed by everything that she said. Like, a lot of the people in, like, my Facebook feed were, like, freaking out. Like, they'd post quotes that she said and get all, like, you could tell they were screaming at their screen. Like, right about 2 minutes in, I was like, all right, she's playing a part. She's being the typical kind of...
She's doing what the college taught her to do.
And like, at that point, I was just like, yeah. Bless your heart.
Not that many who are perfectly willing to sacrifice virtually all of their life to the pursuit of a high-end career. So they'll work... These are men that are very intelligent. They're usually very, very conscientious. They're very driven. They're very high energy. They're very healthy. And they're willing to work 70 or 80 hours a week, nonstop, specialized at one thing to get to the top.
So you're saying women are just more sensible. They don't want that because it's not a nice life.
I'm saying that's part of it, definitely. And so I work
for... So you don't think there are barriers in their way that prevent them getting to the top of those
companies?
Oh,
there are some barriers, yeah. Like men, for example. I mean, to get to the top of any organization is an incredibly competitive enterprise. And the men that you're competing with are simply not going to roll over and say, please take the position.
So let me come back to my question. Is gender equality a myth?
Coming up here is one of the more profound moments of the interview, I think, mm-hmm. is where I think if she at least admits that what he's trying to say, if not he broke through and finally got through and got her to think about something. And he convinces her that it's not necessarily just that... basically that if women want to get paid more or get to the top of these companies, then they have to change their behavior, you know, speaking generally, and they have to do things like the men who are at the top do. You know, you have to spend 80 hours a week trying to get to the top. You have to do all of these things the way men are doing them that are already in that position. And she at least recognizes it, and she basically comes with him, well, why can't it be the other way? Why can't we pay women more for... being women, like, and doing... No, I'm serious. Like, she's like, well, being agreeable, why can't that be paid more? And he's like, well, that's more of the market's decision than it is anything. She's right. Like, the market's dominated by men. Like, actually, no, consumer decisions are made mostly by women. And but the point that he's trying to make is that he straight up says, like, if you're a woman and you want to start a company that focuses on being more agreeable to its employees and having all of these specific things that you think are... woman-like, quote, then that's completely within your prerogative. You could do that, and you can see whether or not it succeeds or fails. And I think that's important. Like, she kind of that's I was kind of taken aback by that. I was expecting more of like cliche talking points, but here she's like, well, why can't the system be more catered towards my personality than towards the dominant male personality or something?
She wants intervention to. Basically give her what she wants.
Right. Don't change your behavior to don't rely on yourself to become more successful.
Right.
Like Don't rely on yourself to do the things necessary to get paid more, to get a higher, to get a more profound, like a CEO position of some big Fortune 500 or whatever. That should be given to an extent because you shouldn't have to change your behavior. It's unfair that your biological womanness, is what she's kind of implying here, is not is preventing you from getting to the top because it doesn't allow you to be less agreeable. It doesn't allow you to forego having kids if you really, really want to have kids. And that affects, you know, the pay gap. These kinds of things, it's unfair that, you know, this is the nature of reality.
Right.
And rather than adjust your decision-making to, you know, I mean, and maybe in a in some grand cosmic sense, it is unfair that that basically businesses get bigger or more effective using the types of traits. Arguably, you know, there aren't a ton of like he says, there aren't a ton of companies out there to demonstrate that this that a woman-centric company management style would give you the same success as a traditional management style.
And those are starting to take off, but economics is a science. It's like gravity. It's right. Like physics. Like you start to intervene in it and you start to change the outcomes, and there's going to be changes in outcomes that you may not like, and
yeah,
you can try and manipulate gravity, but ultimately gravity's still there.
The biggest, and this in my experience, the biggest problem when it comes to typical commentators and people, just general on the man on the street type people, the biggest fallacy slash tragedy that people fall into when thinking about economic decisions, particularly government intervention economics, is a failure of the unseen. You know, we talk about Bastiat and Henry Hazlitt with the fallacy of the unseen, the broken window fallacy.
Right.
The failure to recognize the opportunity cost of any decision you make. And a lot of these policies that are recommended to do this and that, to take it out of the domain of the pay gap, let's look at something like the minimum wage. The minimum wage is historically a right. If you're on the right, you want to get rid of it. If you're on the left, you support it. You know, the living wage is the term.
Somebody didn't tell George Bush that.
Okay, broad strokes.
Yeah.
People like to think, well, it's unfair that, you know, people get paid too small of amount of a wage to afford rent or something. So let's force it up. Let's make it so that you have to get paid this much to work. Like they can't undercut your value or something. And people think that's where it stops. It stops at now you can't get paid less, so you're going to get paid more.
Yay.
And failure, mm-hmm. The failure is that you don't look at the unseen consequences, not only the directly seen consequences of, say, reduction in labor hours because it's too expensive now. So maybe you don't get fired, but you don't work as much. Or maybe they forego hiring that new guy they were going to hire,
right,
because now it's too expensive. But you also fail to see all of the unseen effects in other industries where, you know, and it's hard to even conceptualize them because they haven't come into an existence yet. And this is this is a big problem when it comes to thinking like an economist, is so much of it you kind of have to take on faith. You kind of mm-hmm. have to be like, I know, because I understand how economics works, I know that these other things could happen. They might happen. But like, you see the money going into the bridge. You see the public works project. You see the people working. You see the bridge. You're like, that's good. Those guys have money. Those guys are working. That bridge is there. There wasn't a bridge there before. That's good. And you fail to see all of the other things that could have happened across the country with those tax dollars. Those workers could have been doing this. That concrete could have went here and built this thing. You don't see that stuff. And I think that she doesn't go into it into this amount of depth, but she's starting to get into that should there not be policy to affect these outcomes, because in her mind it will be women get paid more and they don't have to change their being the personality of a woman,
right?
But they don't think about now you just don't know what that will cause, the unintended consequences of that in the future. And that's right. That's a big danger for me looking at it. Like, that's always the big danger for me, is like we almost become hubristic, mm-hmm. to an extent. We think that we can control things more than we actually can. We're not humble enough, you know.
Well, that's, I mean, to put it in the Christian context, like, that's the original sin. Like, that's the whole point of the Bible, is that you eat the fruit of the poisonous tree because you think that you can have the same level of knowledge as God. that even though he's the creator, you think that you have the ability to match him.
Plan and control everything.
And then the entire biblical story, all 66 books, is basically just a continuation of the same story, the same archetype. Man is so hubristic that he thinks he can fix things.
It's the story of us.
Right.
That's why they tell the same story over and over again.
Exactly. That's why we have the archetypes. We have the man with 1,000
but
faces.
But we have to realize that it's organic and you
right.
can't control it.
Exactly.
And
right.
It's an ecosystem that flows naturally.
And that's where she just fundamentally fails, and people who believe in what she believes in, they fundamentally fail is there, no matter what program you put in place, you can't compete with natural order. Like, you just can't do it. Like, there is, even if you are an atheist, there is a natural order to things. There is, human behavior is in a certain route. And business today mimics human survival of 10,000 years ago. Like, you have us acting out the same set of principles that we acted out that kept us alive in prehistoric times, and why Homo sapiens thrived and became the dominant species of animal on this planet. And what she's asking us to do is to completely go against everything that is bred into us over tens of thousands of years. And so she, again, is denying science completely. She's denying evolutionary psychology. And him, having an understanding of that, understands, like, you're asking us to completely change the way that the mind works. Like, yes, people can. He's actually outlining the path, and so are libertarians, of how to counter nature and working with it at the same time. How can we have a more fair society between men and women? Well, you have to make these personal choices to live out those values to achieve this goal that you want.
If you want the business culture to reflect a more agreeable personality type, a more woman-centric personality type, then do it. Go out there and do it.
You have the power.
Yeah.
But you do not have the power to control society and centrally plan certain outcomes, because you will fail.
And if you don't do it, then that's on you. You can't say, well, if you have the opportunity to go affect change and you fail to take that opportunity, to then the consequences of that are also on your head.
Right.
So, like, if you make choices that do not result in a change of the culture of business management, or you don't make the choice for yourself to become less agreeable or something, then that's your choice, and maybe you're happy doing that choice, but you also have to deal with the consequences that you're not going to get paid more, or you're not going to have this business that tries to change the culture of management, you know, corporate management in this country. And those consequences are also a result of your choice.
Right. All right, let's get back to it.
To get to the top.
So you're saying women are just more sensible. They don't want that because it's not a nice life.
I'm saying that's part of it, definitely. And so I work.
So you don't think there are barriers in their way that prevent them getting to the top?
Oh,
of those
there are
companies.
Some barriers. Yeah, like men, for example. I mean, to get to the top of any organization is an incredibly competitive enterprise, and the men that you're competing with are simply not going to roll over and say, "Please take the position."
So let me come back to my question.
It's absolute all-out warfare.
Is gender equality a myth?
I don't know what you mean by the question. Men and women aren't the same, and they won't be the same. That doesn't mean they can't be treated fairly.
Is gender equality desirable?
If it means equality of outcome, then almost certainly it's undesirable. That's already been demonstrated in Scandinavia, because in Scandinavia...
What do you mean by that? Equality of outcome is undesirable.
Well, men and women won't sort themselves into the same categories if you leave them alone to do it of their own accord. I've already seen that in Scandinavia. It's 20 to 1 female nurses to male, something like that. It might not be quite that extreme. And approximately the same male engineers to female engineers. And that's a consequence of the free choice of men and women in the societies that have gone farther than any other societies to make gender equality the purpose of the law. Those are ineradicable differences. You can eradicate them with tremendous social pressure and tyranny, but if you leave men and women to make their own choices, you will not get equal outcomes.
Right, so you're saying that anyone who believes in equality, whether you call them feminists, call them whatever you want to call them, should basically give up because it ain't going to happen.
Only if they're aiming at equality of outcome.
So you're saying give people equality of opportunity, that's fine.
It's not only fine, it's eminently desirable for everyone, for individuals and for society.
But still women aren't going to make it, that's what you're really saying.
It depends on your measurement techniques. They're doing just fine in medicine. In fact, there are far more female physicians than there are male physicians. There are lots of disciplines that are absolutely dominated by women. Many, many disciplines. And they're doing great. So
let me put something else to you from the book. You say the introduction of the equal pay for equal work argument immediately complicates even salary comparison beyond practicality for one simple reason. Who decides what work is equal? It's not possible. So the simple question is, do you believe in equal pay?
Well, I made the argument there. It's like it depends on
who defines
it. So
you don't believe in equal pay?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Because a lot of people listening to you will just say, I mean, are we going back to the dark
ages? That's because you're actually not listening.
I'm listening very carefully, and I'm hearing you basically saying women need to just accept they're never going to make it on equal terms, equal outcomes is how you defined it.
No, I didn't say that.
If I was a young woman watching that, I would go, well, I might as well just go and play with my Cindy dolls and give up trying at school because I'm not going to get the top job I want. Because there's someone sitting there saying it's not possible, it's not desirable, it's going to make you miserable.
Desirable. That's what I said. It's a bad social goal. I didn't say that women shouldn't be striving for the top or anything like that, because I don't believe that for a second.
Striving for the top, but you're going to put all those hurdles in their way, as has been in their way for centuries. And that's fine. You're saying fine.
No. I think I really
the patriarchal system
really
is just
that's
fine.
Silly. I do. I think that's silly. I really do. I mean, look at your situation. You're hardly unsuccessful.
Piss poor in you.
How do you manage? Hard to get
exactly.
Where I've got to.
Good.
So that's
you.
Okay. Battling is good. This is all
it's
about the
inevitable.
Fight. But you talk about men fighting. I mean, let me just put another thing to you from the book.
Why would you have to battle for a high quality position?
Well, I notice in your book you talk about real conversations between men containing, quote, an underlying threat of physicality.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
What about real conversations between women? Is that something, or are we sort of too amenable and reasonable?
No, it's just that the domain of physical conflict is sort of off limits for you.
I mean, and I made that point too. Like, that's why guys tease is it's social ranking. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the higher primate, basically. We're all, you know.
Dudes fight with each other more than girls do.
Right.
Like, that's all that.
He's right here, Creighton. Stop.
But you don't hit a woman.
Right. Like, guys are more combative. We are more interested in social rank and achieving certain statuses, looks. We the choice of partner, success, monetary success. I mean, these are all about social rank. Women do it too, but I think men are much more interested in that fight between each other for dominance.
Right.
And it's mimicked from.
If you look at the history of war, it's predominantly a history of male war.
Dick measuring.
like that doesn't mean that there haven't been female warriors. It doesn't mean that there isn't a female UFC. Like, yeah, but like, let's be honest. Like, when it comes to fighting, that's like mostly guys.
Right.
And it's not mostly girls.
It's and you read the book Chimpanzee Politics by Francis DeWall, and you just go, oh, okay, that's us.
You just said that I fought to get where I've got.
Yeah, but
what does that make me? Well, a proxy man or something?
I don't imagine that you've. Yeah, to like, some degree. I suspect.
I love that
very
part. She's like, I haven't fought. He's like, well, I don't imagine you actually, like, punch someone.
he puts his hands up, yeah.
Physicality.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
What about real conversations between women? Is that something, or are we sort of too amenable and reasonable?
No, it's just that the domain of physical conflict is sort of off limits for you.
I also want to mention, I mean, men, especially in this generation, but over the last 100 years, have made a tremendous effort, an empathetic effort to temper that physicality, especially towards women.
Yeah, violence overall across the world is down.
Right.
As is other violent crimes.
Well, you just said that I fought to get where I've got.
Yeah, but
what does that make me? Well, a proxy man or something?
I don't imagine that you've. Yeah, to some degree, I suspect you're not very agreeable.
So that's the thing. Successful women, I'm not very agreeable.
Right. I've noticed that actually in this conversation.
At least,
and I'm sure it served your career well.
Look at his swagger sitting now, though.
Basically, have to wear the trousers. In your view, they have to sort of become men to succeed. Is what
right? Is he not sitting like he's like sitting like a gangster? Look at him. He is slouched back in his chair because he knows that he
set himself up.
Like he just took control of the interview, and he knows it. He's just sitting back like. He's just got this swagger about him now.
He basically, yeah. I mean, he knows that he just got a shot at. He made her laugh and relax.
Yeah.
And I think he knows that he got her to relax because you know, I'm not very agreeable. And then he says, I noticed that. And then she kind of like cracks a smile. And that puts him at ease a little bit because it kind of, it seems like it broke the tension. But he also kind of like, in a Canadian, that was the Canadian way of saying you're a bitch.
Just rather said that I've fought to get where I've got.
Yeah, but
what does that make me? Well, I don't imagine, man or something?
I don't imagine that you've, yeah, to some degree, I suspect you're not very agreeable.
So that's the thing. Successful women, I'm not very agreeable.
Right. But I've noticed that actually in this conversation.
At least
and I'm sure it served your career well.
Successful women, though, basically have to wear the trousers, in your view. They have to sort of become men to succeed, is what you're saying.
Well, if they're going
to I've had to fight to succeed, therefore I'm an ordinary man.
If they're going to compete against men, certainly masculine traits are going to be helpful. I mean, one of the things I do in my counseling practice, for example, when I'm consulting with women who are trying to advance their careers, is to teach them how to negotiate and to be able to say no and to not be easily pushed around and to be formidable. And you need to, if you're going to be successful, you need to be smart, conscientious, and tough.
Well, here's a radical idea. Why don't the bosses adopt some, the male bosses, shall we say, adopt some female traits so that women don't have to fight and get their sharp elbows out for the pay rises? It's just accepted if they're doing the same job, they get the same pay.
Well, I would say partly because it's not so easy to determine what constitutes the same job.
But you know, that's like, because, arguably,
yeah,
there are still men dominating our industries, our society, and therefore they've dictated the terms for so long that women have to battle to
no,
be like the men.
No, it's not true. It's not true. So, for example,
where's the evidence?
Well, I can give you an example very quickly. So I worked with women who worked in high-powered law firms in Canada for about 15 years, and they were as competent and put together as anybody you would ever meet, and we were trying to figure out how to further their careers. And there was a huge debate in Canadian society at that point that was basically ran along the same lines as your argument, is that if the law firms didn't use these masculine criteria, then perhaps women would do better. But the market sets the damn game. It's like...
And the market is dominated by men.
No, it's not. It's not. The market is dominated by women. They make 80% of the consumer decisions. That's not the case at all.
If you're talking about people who stay at home looking after children... By and large, they are still women, so they're going out doing the shopping. But that is changing.
They make all anyway, the
what
consumer
I
decisions.
You. Okay, so
the
what
market is
you?
Driven
okay.
by women, not men.
Right.
Okay, and if you're a lawyer in Canada,
and they still pay more for the same sort of goods, that's been proven. That men, for that you buy a blue bicycle helmet, it's going to cost less than a pink one. Anyway, we'll come on to that.
It's partly because men are less agreeable. Right. So they won't put up with it.
I want to ask you. Is it not desirable to have some of those female traits you're talking about? I'd say that's a generalization, but you've used the words female traits. Is it not desirable to have some of them at the top of business? I mean, maybe there wouldn't have
they
been
don't predict
a banking crisis.
They don't predict success in the workplace. The things that predict success in the workplace are intelligence and conscientiousness. Agreeableness negatively predicts success in the workplace. And so does high
that,
negative emotion.
You're saying that women aren't intelligent enough to run these top companies?
No, I didn't say that at all.
You said that... female traits don't predict success.
But I didn't say that intelligence wasn't. I didn't say that intelligence and conscientiousness.
Well, you were saying that intelligence and conscientiousness, by implication, are not female traits.
No, no.
I mean, that's very dangerous territory.
I'm not saying that at all.
Are women less intelligent than men, by and large?
No, they're not. No, the data on that's pretty clear. The average IQ for a woman and the average IQ for a man is identical. There is some debate about the flatness of the distribution, which is something that James Damore pointed out, for example, in his memo, but there's no difference at all in general cognitive ability. There's no difference.
And as I said, I mean, women that I've dealt with and the women that I've worked with are more conscientious than the men. I mean,
you disagree with what he's saying.
No, I'm saying that...
They're not equal. Women are smarter.
No, I'm
in general for your cases.
I'm saying that intelligence is something that you can. I mean, you can become more intelligent over time. I mean, the more you challenge yourself, but conscientiousness is very controllable. Like, are you going to show up and work hard? Are you going to wake up every single morning and choose to be successful at X, Y, and Z that day? Are you going to choose in the morning to be excited about your life that day? And I think people don't make that choice. People make that choice and say, "Oh, life's happening to me today," instead of saying, "I last year made an effort. Last year was the best year of my life ever, and it's because I had one simple resolution. Every single day I wake up, I'm going to do one good thing for myself in these different categories. emotional, physical, spiritual, health-wise, get some sun.
Cake.
Yes.
To speak of in conscientiousness.
I had a piece of $160 cake today. It was the best thing I did for myself all day. And as a result, I started learning all these different habits to do better at taking care of myself. And I ended up changing my mind, changing my brain, and becoming a more conscientious, present person in every area of my life by doing that baby stepping. That's what he's saying. And women, by and large, do more of that. Women are way better at caring for themselves than men. Like, how many men die at 55 because they won't go to the doctor? Well, I don't know. I feel like I had a heart attack. It's gas.
Tis but a scratch.
Right. You know, so I think it's very controllable. So I think the idea that, oh, so you're saying that, this is my female voice, you're saying that women aren't intelligent and conscientious. It's like, what? What are you saying?
And I like how he straight up says, like, the data is very clear that men and women have the same average intelligence.
Right.
Like I'm not saying that at all. It is very, very clear.
Right.
Women are a bit more orderly than men, and men are a little bit more industrious than women. But the difference isn't big. But that averages into consciousness.
And in men who aren't necessarily as
industrious. Well, of course.
But
female traits,
you asked though, me a question. Why are they not...
Feminine traits.
Why are they not desirable at the top of... Feminine traits, why are they not desirable at the top of business?
It's hard to say. I'm just laying out the empirical evidence. Like, we know the traits that predict success.
But we also know, because companies by and large have not been dominated by women over the centuries, we have nothing to compare it to. It's an experiment.
True, and it could be the case that if companies modified their behavior and became more feminine, that they would be successful. But
you
there's no evidence for it. I'm not neither doubtful nor non-doubtful. There's no evidence
for
it.
So why not give it a go as the radical feminist?
Because the evidence suggests, well, it's fine. If someone wants to start a company and make it more feminine and compassionate, let's say, and caring in its overall orientation towards its workers and towards the marketplace, then that's a perfectly reasonable experiment to run. My point is that there is no evidence that those traits predict success in the workplace. And there's
because
this evidence
never been tried.
Well, that's not really the case. Women have been in the workplace for, what, at least ever since I've been around, the representation of women in the workplace has been about 50%. So we've run the experiment for a fairly reasonable period of time, but not, you know, certainly not for centuries.
Let me move on to another debate that's been very controversial for you.
I just want to say, like, there's this tendency amongst feminists where men and women should be equal in all traits and all things. Like, Gavin McInnes says...
It's the equality of outcomes that he's talking about.
Right, and Gavin McInnes is saying this to be provocative and to be anti-feminist, and I think he's being a dick when he says it, but he says, women are shitty men. You know, and he's doing it for the obvious reasons, but I would say men are shitty women too. And there's things about each one of the sexes that complement each other, and those things should be celebrated as opposed to these traits are bad and these traits are good, when in reality they're all very complementary if we change the actual dialogue that we're all having. And that's kind of what I feel like he's saying. It's like, it's neither good nor bad, it's just how it is.
Right.
And she's saying, well, no, these are bad traits, and
there, and like, there's nothing inherently good or bad about, and there's nothing, like, it's one of these, it's the age old debate within I'd say Western civilization about the balance of, like, whether or not material equality and I guess physical equality is in and of itself something worth striving for.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, because, you know, we are inherently unequal. Like, you know,
right.
Some people are taller than others. Some people are faster. Some people, you know, are naturally more gifted at the piano. Like, there's all of these various traits, and some of that comes down to your gender as well. Some, you know, women just biologically on average tend to be more woman-like, and
mm-hmm.
men biologically tend to be more male-like, and the fact that you can, you know what I mean when I say that,
right,
says that it's pretty ingrained in our culture. And like, not, is that inherently bad? And I think that's a major debate that's worth having. Is like, if you think that is inherently bad, then I think that's kind of a problem. Like,
mm-hmm.
like, this isn't anything that's in anybody's control. There's nothing inherently bad about being born different, and using the talents and skill, the talents that you're given at birth to the best of your ability. Like, there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
And there's also no reason that we should take some extra some institution to try and correct it. Like, I think Kurt Vonnegut wrote a book about how they tried to make everyone equal. Like, they put scales on the pianist's finger so he couldn't play too well, and they weighed down the dancer so they couldn't dance too well. And it's like, it took this equality argument to its logical conclusion. It's like, for libertarians, and I would say just Western civilization in general, it's always been equality under the law that's important. Like, mm-hmm. we want people to be treated equally by the law.
For instance, if I send treasonous text messages and emails, I would expect that those get deleted by the FBI as well.
Or you'd go to prison.
Right. I'm just saying that, and likewise, if someone is committing treason and sending text messages and emails about it, they should be charged with they should be investigated, as opposed to the government just deleting those emails because they work for the government.
Right. Yeah. Equality under the law is what's worth striving for. And then there's the entirely different conversation of whether or not equality, material equality and such, are worth striving for. You know, you have the Karl Marxes that said that it is necessary, it is good. What is his face that just wrote that book a few years back about how inequality in and of itself causes economic downturns and lack of growth? Thomas Piketty, I think.
Yeah.
It's like you have these guys that are trying to argue that inequality, material inequality in and of itself is bad. Whereas I would say that it's not inequality that's bad, it's inequality under the law that's bad.
And Renee makes a good point, is we're measuring women's happiness and everyone's happiness by salary.
Right. and we're also measuring it by a male metric. Like, right. Like we're talking about whether or not they're more manlike is like, if that's the equality. It's like whether or not they're more manlike.
Right.
It's not so much whether or not they're treated equally, it's whether or not they're taken on the traits of men to such a degree that, you know, they're not considered male or female traits anymore. They're just the traits of both.
Right.
And I think that's also inherently a problem. It's, you know, you should be treated for yourself, not because you've tried to adapt yourself to an entirely different group of people.
Maybe too many people are surviving. Maybe that's just the problem. Maybe we need a Malthusian crisis. What do you think?
It's all part of this.
It's too bad it won't happen because Malthus was wrong.
Well, he's been proven wrong now, but we beat Malthus. We kicked his ass.
And this is, you got in trouble for refusing to call trans men and women by their preferred personal pronouns.
No, that's not actually true. I got in trouble because I said I would not follow the compelled speech dictates of the federal and provincial government. I actually never got in trouble for not calling anyone anything.
Right.
That didn't happen.
You wouldn't follow the change of law, which was designed
not
to
once
outlaw
it was law.
Discrimination.
No, no.
Why
that, well, that's
your,
what they said it was designed to do.
Okay. You cited freedom of speech in that. Why should your right to freedom of speech trump a trans person's right not to be offended?
Because in order to be able to think, you have to risk being offensive. I mean, look at the conversation we're having right now. You know, like, you're certainly willing to risk offending me in the pursuit of truth. Why should you have the right to do that? It's been rather uncomfortable.
Trump.
That is the most important thing said in all of this.
Yes.
Right,
and
absolutely.
It's one of the most important things that I've heard in a long time. And it is the thing that made me go, okay, this is art. This is a masterpiece. Because it's so true. We are so worried about offending and wanting to please people that we are sacrificing intellectualism for the sake of making sure that everybody feels comfortable. Because nobody wants to make anybody feel uncomfortable, but let's just listen to this again because it made my nipples hard.
A trans person's right not to be offended.
Because in order to be able to think, you have to risk being offensive. I mean, look at the conversation we're having right now. You know, like, you're certainly willing to risk offending me in the pursuit of truth. Why should you have the right to do that? It's been rather uncomfortable.
I mean, for a Canadian, there's a little bit of blood dripping from those lips when he
says
that.
Oh, his face, his facial expression, he was like
angry.
He's on point.
It's
like,
been rather uncomfortable.
This is important. Let me change my facial expression.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad I put you on the spot.
Well,
I'm very glad that I have exercised my freedom of speech.
You get my point. It's like you're doing what you should do, which is digging a bit to see what the hell's going on.
So
and that is what you should do. But you're exercising your freedom of speech to certainly risk offending me. And that's fine. I think more power to you as far as I'm concerned.
Except you haven't sat there and... I'm just trying to work that out. I mean...
Ha, gotcha. Yeah.
You have got me. I'm trying to work that through my head. Yeah. It took a while.
It did, yeah.
It took a while. You have voluntarily come into the studio and agreed to be questioned. A trans person in your class has come to your class and said they want to be called...
Never happened. And I would call them she.
So you would. So you've kind of changed your tune on that.
No, I said that right from the beginning. What I said at the beginning was that I was not going to cede the linguistic territory to radical leftists, regardless of whether or not it was put in law.
This is important to note for him. This is something, and this I don't think he goes into it in this interview very much, but this is something that he's talked about before, and it's in particular because of this law in Canada, which, if you're unfamiliar, in Canada they passed a law that required businesses and every person
in Canada
you were compelled by law to use the preferred pronoun that a person suggested for themselves.
And he was a professor at the Toronto University and basically said, this is inappropriate.
He said he's not going to follow that law should the operate. Like he said, now he's also said in his class and in general, and I guess in his own life, that he would respect the wishes of a trans person should they ask, you know, I would like to be called a male or a female,
right,
whatever. He said that he would be perfectly willing to do that. So that's something that he gets typecasted as, like, anti-trans guy, but he's actually said that he's not opposed to the trans part. He's opposed to the law compelling speech. And he goes into, in other videos, he goes into detail, and it's a very eloquent argument for free speech, and is that He knows the reason he's so against it is because he knows what he calls them, the radical leftist, feminist, trans, Marxist, postmodernist, you know, it's all these,
right,
the
Antifa people.
But like he knows what they're trying to do with these laws. It isn't some benevolent, we're trying to make sure that people's feelings don't get hurt. He knows that's not the point of the law. The point of the law and the point of any kind of free speech compulsion is thought control. He says the way, and like I said, there's other videos where he goes into this, the way that we as humans, 90% of how we interact with each other is through speech. There's body language and, you know, there's things like that. But like, it's all, a majority of it is words and speech. And like, this is how our brain, the ideas in our brains, really our personality is in our brains. Like, this is how we present ourselves to the world.
It's the software of the human experience.
And when you control speech, you're controlling thought. And that's what he knows that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to convert people's thoughts,
right,
on the issue and not allow free thinking to happen. And that's what he is most opposed to. It's not that he doesn't like trans people, it's that he knows that these people, because they've done it before, maybe not in the United States, because we've actually got a good history when it comes to free speech, but in other countries, particularly in Europe, they have taken over they have basically removed certain opinions from even being able to be discussed, and it has converted the thoughts of people, and he knows that that's what they're trying to do, and he just disagrees vehemently with their worldview. So he's like, I'm not even going to pretend to be okay with this law.
And you see in this entire interview, you see doublespeak. You know, 1984 is a book by George Orwell that basically explains what a totalitarian state looks like. And it was basically his attempt to explain what people in Russia were living under. And this is where free societies can move if you allow these sorts of tendencies to take place. And doublespeak is war is peace. What are some of the other doublespeak?
War is peace, ignorance is strength, war is peace, ignorance is strength, freedom is slavery.
Yeah, freedom is slavery. And in our politics today, you see so much doublespeak. We've talked often about how Donald Trump will say the opposite of what your eyes tell you, and then you see other people go, well, it's what he said. He completely doublespeaked an entire group of supporters. That is dangerous, and that's why people have a strong reaction to him. You see in this interview somebody who's on the complete opposite aisle doublespeaking. You're reframing what he is saying as basically a dog whistle to your viewers and to other people. I don't want you to think about the complexity of what he just said. I want you to think about what I want you to think about.
Right. And in 1984, it's important to point out that one of the reasons that they did this speech compulsion and this newspeak and doublespeak and all this is because there's a point where he talks about how they got a person to say 2 + 2 = 5. Mm-hmm. And it was at the beginning of they torture him, basically. But at the beginning, he says it because he doesn't want to be tortured. But by the end of it, he says it because he literally believes mm-hmm. that 2 + 2 = 5.
Stockholm syndrome.
Right.
Yeah. So there was another point I wanted to make, but let's continue on.
And then the people who came after me said, oh, you must be transphobic and you mistreat a student in your class. It's like, I never mistreated a student in my class. I'm not transphobic. And that isn't what I said.
Well, except you've also called trans campaigners authoritarian, haven't you? I mean, isn't that grossly...
Well, only in the broader context of my claims that radical leftist ideologues are authoritarian,
yes,
which they are.
You're saying someone who is trying to work out their gender identity, who may well have struggled with that, had quite a
no
tough
doubt
time over the years.
With it, yeah.
You're comparing them with, you know, Chairman Mao, who
no, just
saw
the
deaths of millions of people. Well,
just
even
activists.
If the activists, you know, they're trans people too. They have a right to say these things.
Yeah, but they don't have a right to speak for their whole community.
To compare them to Chairman Mao or, you know, I could Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet. I mean, you know, this is grossly insensitive.
I didn't compare them to Pinochet.
Well,
I did compare them to
he
Mao.
Was an authoritarian.
He's a right winger, though. I was comparing them to the left wing totalitarians.
Okay.
And I do believe
Mao,
they are left wing totalitarians.
Under Mao, millions of people died.
Right.
I mean, there's no comparison between Mao and a trans activist, is there?
Why not?
Because trans activists aren't killing millions of people?
The philosophy that's guiding their utterances is the same philosophy.
The consequences are.
Not yet.
You're saying that trans activists
no.
could lead to the deaths of millions of people.
What no, I'm saying that the philosophy that drives their utterances is the same philosophy that already has driven us to the deaths of millions of people.
Okay, tell us how that philosophy...
And
they
the left hates when you bring up the genocides of Mao and Stalin.
But
they really do.
It's just
to this day, they can't stand it.
But it's just the idea of ideas have consequences.
Right.
And her brain, she literally can't compute what he's saying.
He was perfect. He said it and he just sat there and waited for her to process that.
Right.
Because he knew that she didn't know, understand what he was saying.
And that's the, I mean, that's
comeback.
So many.
There was nothing there.
And it's not, like, I'm not going to call a leftist thing. So many people just don't think about the actual consequences of what they're saying.
The failure of of the unseen. Like,
right.
They can't think about long-term consequences of actions. Like, We kind of get mocked whenever we say, you know, some liberal policy like, you know, why don't you support socialism or this? And it's like, well, it killed millions of people. And they're like, oh, pff, you know, blah, 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 that was totalitarian. That was state socialism.
No. Right.
Blah, 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 blah. And it's like, you know, if you can't, you just, they think that because it's not as strong as like literally the October Revolution,
mm-hmm.
that it's not in the same vein because they don't see that the October Revolution didn't just happen out of nowhere. It was a series of steps, a series of ideas. You know, socialism, utopian socialism goes back to like the 14, 1500s. Like these ideas, they kept happening. And then Karl Marx comes along and like puts like an economic edifice to it. And Lenin sees that. And he's got the same time that you have the Russian czars and like all of these things, they compound on each other. And it, you know, those ideas that started off as just sort of like, you know, let's try and imagine a utopia turns into what eventually would become the October Revolution and all of the atrocities of Soviet Russia. And, you know, but they like to try and say that this isn't necessarily what could happen. This is just what happened in this case. And
mm-hmm.
and I disagree. This is a product
yeah.
of the ideology. It is inherent in the ideology because the ideology is fundamentally one of control.
It is the end result 100% of the time.
It is fundamentally about controlling people.
Mm-hmm.
It is about controlling their desires. It's about controlling their wishes and what they want to do with their lives as much as it is about controlling where resources go in a market. And this is maybe something that Hayek talked about in The Road to Serfdom, is like, why do the worst people get in charge of these things? It's because it is the personification of those bad things. It's like, we try and talk about benevolent government and using government for good, and that's a laudable goal to a lot of people, and progressives honestly believe that this is something, government can be used for good. You know, we have the social welfare programs to help people out, and you know, in the grand scheme of things, you know, like welfare, like food stamps and stuff is innocuous, really. I mean, it's helpful to the people. It's probably beneficial more than it's not beneficial, and in general, and at least as it's used in the United States today, maybe in the future it'll be abused. It has been abused, but like on the whole, if I were to say, is food stamps superficially a bad thing, I'd probably say no, because people probably use it beneficially.
What he's saying is isolating it to just that one issue.
Right. But like, if you look at it from the perspective of the whole ideology of control, of controlling people's money, their desires, and you have to realize that to a large extent, work, your job, like that is part of your personality. Like we talk, like when somebody says, you know, what do you do? Like, you meet someone new, like, hey, my name's, you know, John Smith. Somebody says, well, what do you do? Like, that is sort of like a way for people to judge who you are as a person.
What's your status?
Because, and it doesn't necessarily economic status as much as it's like, it's you know, what is all of this time? Because we spend all of this time in our lives and all this, our brains on these, I guess Ayn Rand would call it the men of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
But we spend all this time on these endeavors in our lives that it really is it's impossible to separate the work we do from the people we are, because they build on each other.
Right.
And so when you talk about controlling people's work and even their money, you know, and their food and the resources,
purchasing decisions,
you're talking about controlling people.
Who they are.
Mm-hmm. And if you're controlling people, it is just natural that you're going to have a state like the Soviet Union, or a state like Mao's China, or the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. Those are the kinds of things that naturally erupt from the fundamental assertion that we should control other people.
Right.
That's where it comes from.
Yeah, and he is somebody who has studied Nazi Germany in depth, and I am too, and I think there's so... You look at these tendencies in society where you go, we're one really bad economic crisis away from a totalitarian state. I mean, Trump to me is a canary in the coal mine. That people will accept the erosion of truth, that people will accept the erosion of institutions, that people will accept, you know, doublespeak for momentary pleasure or momentary punishment of who they feel have punished them, and he's a backlash against control, but he is a different kind of control in and of itself, in my opinion. I mean, he is somebody who has, if he went into the White House thinking that he was an emperor. Fortunately, we're not so far gone as a society that he doesn't have the ability. As we've been sitting here, we're getting updates, you know, from... You know, all these news. So here's one from CBS News. President Trump ordered Robert Mueller fired last summer. He backed down when the White House counsel refused and threatened to quit, the New York Times reports. You know, here's somebody who, well, if you're looking into me, I'll just get rid of you. You know, he has no appreciation for the rule of law. And that's a very scary tendency. And there's a lot of people who will just whitewash that and say, that's okay because he's our guy.
And that's what a lot of people did during the Obama administration.
Right.
And that's biting a lot of people in the butt now with all these surveillance things coming out, is that, you know, it was always that it's not going to be abused. You know, you give the executive the authority, it's okay because the executive is benevolent. But what happens when it's not a benevolent guy? And it turns out the benevolent guy wasn't even benevolent to begin with.
You go back to 2013 and you listen to the podcast in 2012, 2013 as Snowden was coming out. You will hear in this program us say, what happens when this is used for political reasons?
And what happens when the guy in charge is not a guy you agree with?
Yep. And both of those came true.
What happens when we find out Obama abused these powers?
Right. Well, if Trump had abused the powers, we'd all be flipping out. But
oh, he will.
We like Obama.
If he hasn't already.
Right. Yeah.
He's just, we'll just find out about him on the next president.
Bush probably abused him. And yeah. then, I mean, this, he did. And this, this abuse of these kinds of powers goes all the way back, like, I mean, even like Woodrow Wilson, you know, with like the Espionage Act and abusing that to lock up Germans. Like these kinds of things, they're just ripe for abuse.
Yeah, Trump is too incompetent to figure out the tools that he has at his disposal, thank goodness, because he has the right temperament to abuse them, but he doesn't have the knowledge.
The most disappointing part of Trump is that we now know aliens aren't real. Because he couldn't have kept his mouth shut.
Any way comparable?
Sure, that's no problem. The first thing is that the philosophy presumes that group identity is paramount. That's the fundamental philosophy that drove the Soviet Union and Maoist China. And it's the fundamental philosophy of the left-wing activists. It's identity politics. It doesn't matter who you are as an individual. It matters who you are in terms of your group identity.
You're just saying things, though, to provoke, aren't you? I mean, you are a provocateur.
I never say
anything.
You're
like the alt-right that you hate to be compared to. You want to stir things up.
I'm only a provocateur insofar as when I say what I believe to be true, it's provocative. I don't provoke.
I love that line. So
maybe for humor.
You don't set out
now and then. I'm not interested
maybe
in provoking.
For humor.
But what about the thing about, you know, fighting and the lobster? Tell us about the lobster.
See, this is a common rhetorical tactic. Like, you're actually a ridiculous person. Here's a ridiculous thing that you said one time that's out of context. Right, like you're the lobster man.
I like how he goes, well, that was a segue.
Right. Let's eat that up again.
It's who you are in terms of your group identity.
You're just
that's
saying
murderous
things, though, to provoke, aren't you? I mean,
not
you are a provocateur.
I never say
you're like
anything.
The alt-right that you hate to be compared to. You want to stir things up.
I'm only a provocateur insofar as when I say what I believe to be true, it's provocative. I don't provoke. Maybe for humor.
You don't set out to
now
provoke.
And then. I'm not interested in provoking.
But what about the thing about, you know, fighting and the lobster? Tell us about the lobster.
Well, that's quite a segue. Well, the first chapter I have in my book is called Stand Up Straight with Your Shoulders Back. And it's an injunction to be combative, not least to further your career, let's say, but also to adopt a stance of ready engagement with the world and to reflect that in your posture. And the reason that I write about lobsters is because there's this idea that hierarchical structures are a sociological construct of the Western patriarchy. And that is so untrue that it's almost unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And I use the lobster as an example because the lobster, we divulged from lobsters in evolutionary history about 350 million years ago, common ancestor. And lobsters exist in hierarchies and they have a nervous system attuned to the hierarchy. And that nervous system runs on serotonin, just like our nervous systems do. And the nervous system of the lobster and of the human being is so similar that antidepressants work on lobsters. Huh. And it's part of my attempt to demonstrate that the idea of hierarchy has absolutely nothing to do with sociocultural construction, which it doesn't.
Let me just get this straight. You're saying that we should organize our societies along the lines of the lobsters.
I'm saying that it's inevitable that there will be continuity in the way that animals and human beings organize their structures. It's
They hate that.
Yes,
apart. They hate that argument. They hate whenever you say that a lot of the way society works is visible in lesser animals, and that it's not just something that we just made up one day.
Right?
Like, they can't.
They can't.
It's not powerful men that run the market that created this.
Somebody
idea?
That I can blame to not fix myself. Like, I think that's a very powerful statement that it's inevitable that we will one day run society in the way that other animals run society, and we will cast off the chains of stupid ideology like communism and Marxism and all of these ideologies that seek to grow the state because it's a fool's errand. And eventually human beings will listen to science and understand science and look at how things are actually organized, and one day we'll operate in the way that we were born to operate, which is individualism, individual rights, spontaneous order, free markets, the virtue of production, natural harmony of interest, peace. And you start to see that the libertarian philosophy starts to, once you put all these things together, you start to have everything come into focus, and you see everything fit together, and you start to see that this is the ideology of how humans actually behave, between libertarianism, Austrian ideology, non-interventionism, Austrian economics, and non-interventionism. Like, you start to see all these things come together, and you go, okay, this is how human beings actually operate. This is how we should actually order society, and this is how we will eventually operate society. So what do we have to do to get to that point? And we're definitely not there yet, but libertarians have to understand that they are the beacon of light for the future of humanity. And if you are personally not taking care of yourself, you're not intellectually as rigorous as Jordan Peterson, then you are failing.
Well, that's a little harsh. the guy is like the clinical psychologist, like doctorate. Like,
why would I set a standard for our listeners that isn't the top?
Basically, my opinion on all this is, you don't have to be the smartest person in the world. Just be the smartest guy in the room.
Just be the best lobster you can be.
It's absolutely inevitable. And there is 1/3 of a billion years of evolutionary history behind that. Right? That's so long that 1/3 of a billion years ago, there weren't even trees. It's a long time. You have a mechanism in your brain that runs on serotonin that's similar to the lobster mechanism that tracks your status. And the higher your status, the better your emotions are regulated. So as your serotonin levels increase, you feel more positive emotion and less negative emotion.
So you're saying, like the lobsters, we're hardwired as men and women to do certain things, to sort of run along tram lines, and there's nothing we can do about it.
No, I'm not saying
there's nothing we can do about it, because it's like in a chess game, right? There's lots of things that you can do, although you can't break the rules of the chess game and continue to play chess. And your biological nature is somewhat like that, is it sets the rules of the game, but within those rules you have a lot of leeway. But the idea that, but one thing we can't do is say that hierarchical organization is a consequence of the capitalist patriarchy. It's like, that's patently absurd. It's wrong. It's not a matter of opinion. It's seriously wrong.
Aren't you just whipping people up into a state of anger?
And not at all.
Divisions between men and women. Mm. You're stirring people up. You know, you have any critics of you online get absolutely lambasted by your followers.
You've and by me, off, generally.
You? Sorry, your critics get lambasted by you. I mean, isn't
that
academics, irresponsible?
Not at all. If an academic is going to come after me and tell me that I'm not qualified and that I don't know what I'm talking about,
so you're not going to say to your followers now, quit the abuse, quit the anger.
Well, we'd need some substantial examples of the abuse and the anger before I could detail that question.
There's a lot of it out there.
Let's take a more general perspective on that. So I've had 25,000 letters since June, something like that, from people who told me that I've brought them back from the brink of destruction. And so I'm perfectly willing to put that up against the rather vague accusations that my followers are making the lives of people that I've targeted miserable.
Jordan Peterson, thank you.
My pleasure. Nice talking with you.
It's nice talking to you. Yeah, the Milo Yiannopoulos also is absolutely hysterical. If you want to go watch Kathy Newman try and debate Milo, and he destroys her. On that last question, there is a website out there. Essentially, somebody out there watches all of these like hate storms that go back and forth, and Channel 4 has basically said that that they had to hire security for her because she's been so harassed. But this headline: Kathy Newman's feminist fans aimed 30 times more violent sexist abuse at Peterson and his supporters than vice versa. So they study all of the different hashtags and all the different comments, and they found that Jordan Peterson was actually far more abused on Twitter. But this goes to
By the media, too.
By the media, absolutely.
Initially, I feel like the media was very trying to spin it sympathetically for her.
I know that we shouldn't take tweets as news, but user Cheeky Scrump has outlined a step-by-step process of how these types of interviews, where you have somebody who is an alternative voice to the liberal narrative in the media, how they're destroyed. And I thought this was a really interesting breakdown of what actually happens. Step one, change the conversation from the loss of the debate to the vile online abuse having the debate caused. Channel 4 are making a big show of this, hiring a security agent, but curiously showing no evidence of threats. Step one, part two, these articles allow the media to frame Jordan Peterson as being transphobic or outright lies like him being alt-right. This removes people from the primary source video and controls the narrative about what Jordan Peterson believes. So you don't see on your Twitter feed, your Facebook, or any of the clickbait mills like Huffington Post saying, you know, watch this video. This is a really stimulating conversation from somebody who has an alternative narrative. They choose different pieces from the interview, make him look like an extremist. They focus on the hate. And so what they're trying to do is to keep you from defending him or bringing it up or mentioning it, because they're using shame to keep you from enlightening other people in the group. Shame is a prehistoric tool that it says in your brain, gosh, if I do something stupid, I will be shamed by the group and kicked out of the group, and that will mean I will die on some rock in the middle of Abu Dhabi. And so shame has been weaponized by the left because they are using it to keep you from actually standing up and saying, this was a really intelligent, this podcast or this conversation, like, you don't want to share that because this guy is really offensive because one time he said feminism is cancer or whatever. So they take things out of context and drive down the value of that person because it's social proof. If you have a lot of people around you talking about you, then other people listening to that conversation think that you are higher in the hierarchy. If you have a lot of people talking negative about you, it drives down your value. Step two, Peterson will be asked to disavow his fan base and conflated with any and all online abuse of women receive. His refusal to roll over in the face of this will be framed as an endorsement of harassment, and the more naked agenda media will carry endless hit pieces. Step three, having Peterson on a TV show or at an event will be reframed as dangerous to women or endorsing a harasser. He will be banned from the UK events, and interviews will be canceled due to quote-unquote safety. Step four, Peterson's mere presence on social media and YouTube will be called into question. Calls will be made for his hateful rhetoric that encourages harassment to be banned from the internet. Marxist trans activists are already doing this, but online media will follow suit. It is the same old strategy from the far left. If you lose a debate, reframe their arguments as harassment and ban, harass, and smear the person making them. Peterson had his YouTube channel turned off at one point.
In the middle of a live video.
In the middle of a live video, his YouTube turned his channel off and banned him. So I think that is a pretty sensible breakdown of what actually happens. And you see it all the time. You have to sit there and go, okay, I've heard this thing about Alex Jones. Is this the truth? Go watch Alex Jones and find out for yourself. Like, anytime you hear a name in the news and you're kind of like, who's this new name that I'm hearing, this Milo person or this, you know, what, it happens on the right with Roseanne or whatever.
Chris Spangle.
Like, go and check them out for yourself. Like, hear what they actually have to say, because I think you will find, like, oh, they're just overblowing this. And you have all of these sites, like, libertarians. I know we want to say that, like, so, like, all these big companies are free market giants, Facebook, Apple, Google, Amazon, Twitter, like, oh, they're our friends, because this is not the government. These are government shills. Like, these are stooges for the government.
Google is my friend.
Google may be your friend, but they own YouTube, and they are shills for the leftist agenda. They are giving in to these kind of people. They are banning people like Peterson. They are banning people like us. And they are giving in to censorship. And so these bastions of free speech that we have celebrated as expanding the ability of human beings to communicate, they are giving in to government pressure and turning over records repeatedly, giving them back doors to the FISA courts, and giving in to the left. I mean, James Darrymore was fired because he had an alternate opinion from what the corporation wanted. And if you go and read what he actually said, none of it was really any – it wasn't even offensive. I mean, it was offensive to some because they were offended.
So when's the first banned episode of – well, Kevin?
I don't know.
Because
we'll see.
Like if Peterson was banned from YouTube, like you say, then we just played his whole clip.
Of course.
So this would be banned then from that as well.
You what are you saying? Like he was already turned off.
He's trying to defend Google.
I know. You're being ridiculous.
It's a slippery slope.
Of course. These corporations are structured in a way that satisfies government and not actual free speech.
I know. Creighton won't debate me at all tonight.
I know. I love it.
I hate it.
This has been my favorite episode of We Are Libertarians.
Oh, great.
And you didn't even fight.
I loved it, too.
I know. It was great. So let's give our final thoughts on this. Let's start wrapping up.
Be a man.
Be a man.
That's what we learned from Peterson.
Yep. And that's why you're wearing that little beanie on that head.
It's a big beanie.
I mean,
it's not a little beanie. It covers my ears.
All right. Well, I'm just saying, I don't wear a hat like that.
Oh. Well, there's your first problem.
Hipster.
You didn't grow a beard before either.
You're right. Yeah.
You stepped up your manhood.
Beard's very full. Gulp.
Thank you.
Creighton, final thoughts.
I'd say if you've never heard of Jordan Peterson or if this is the only thing you've ever seen of him, go look at some of his stuff. He's you know, I would not say that he is. He calls himself libertarian. I've never seen him call himself libertarian. So he's not like, you know, a Cato think tank guy. He's just a guy who has a particular animosity for like modern, you know, hardcore Marxism and stuff. And that has brought him to the attention of people like us.
Right.
But in general, I'd say that his ideas are, they're pretty good. I'd say they're pretty empowering. I mean, and like we said, they're not empowering to just men. They're empowering to, I'd say, anybody who is willing to listen that says, you know, if you're not interested in just the politics of it, you're looking at like his perception of how people should act.
Right.
Then I think it's pretty good. Like it just, he says, you know, it like we said a minute ago, is very, very existentialist of him is that, you know, if there's no meaning in the world, then you have to make your own meaning and it's on your shoulders to make your life as you want it. And you succeed and failed, mostly on your own merits and your personality, your choices are your choices and the consequences of making or lacking or not making any of those choices are your consequences, and you have to take responsibility for that. And I like that. I don't know if maybe I was just raised that way, but it's like, you know, if you want to do something, go out and do it. And if it takes a lot of work, then so be it. Put in the work and do it. And so I always appreciated him before this interview, and then I saw this and was like, man, this guy is like a Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, go check him out some more. He's a cool dude.
Be who you want to be, you are. He's like Yoda.
Kermit Yoda. Yeah. Final thoughts, Smangle?
Go for it. I always wrap up so I can go right into the end.
I don't have much else to say. I don't know.
We said it all.
What do we want to hear?
We said a lot here.
Yeah, I mean, this was a pretty long show, right?
That's about all I have to say about that.
And that's all I need to say about that.
Is this the last one?
This is the last time before Creighton goes off to New York City.
Really?
Man. Yeah.
You're not going to have another one of these in the next...
I mean, you can come back next Thursday. You guys can come back next Thursday. It's Thursday if you want.
I don't leave until, like, the 20th.
Oh, okay.
One more.
Well, keep going. Let's keep going. Every Thursday night. yeah, because we know we'll never see you again after you leave.
It's the end of Creighton.
Yep.
New York will consume him.
I'm amazed we got him back at all.
I know.
So... he went to D.C. and he tried for a while, but then we kind of lost contact, and then we got him in trouble with his boss, and then...
it's hard to get him away from the weights.
Yeah, pounding those weights, bruh. I want to say that I think a big part of this is understanding that your actions and the things that you're putting out in the world, that they actually reflect who you are as a person, because I think it's so easy to get lost in social media and build a character sometimes and say things that you don't actually mean for... Because it's like why road rage is a thing. You don't actually think that that's a person in the car. You're ranting at the car. And the scientists have found that you're disassociating from the humanity of the person in the car and you're freaking out. And so we have a tendency, I think, to do that online and just pay attention. Like... that is a huge part of this. Like you see in such stark terms the difference between simplicity and complexity in conversation and try to be a Jordan Peterson and not a Kathy Newman. All right, thank you for joining us here on this episode of We Are Libertarians. We want to thank Craig DaCosta, Brandon Luke, Jason Doolittle, and Christy Avery for... I'm sorry, I put Christy Avery last. I should start with Christy Avery because she's a woman.
Let's try that again.
Christy Avery, Brandon Luke, Jason DaCosta, or Jason Doolittle, Craig DaCosta, sorry, for being our $100 a month subscribers to We Are Libertarians. You can subscribe and get all our bonus content at patreon.com/WeAreLibertarians. Seriously, $5, $10 a month. I have been invited to be on Radio Row at Students for Liberty, their conference, LibertyCon, in March, and I'd really like to go, but it's a financial decision, it's a financial thing, and the more of you that can contribute to that, then I can bring you great coverage of what's actually happening out there in the freedom movement, especially with the younger crowd. I'm going to be, hello, fellow students, how do you do?
Hello!
And if you want to contribute towards that travel fund, then at the bottom of wearelibertarians.com is the one-time donation button for PayPal. Love for you to send me to Washington, D.C. so I can report from Radio Row. It's actually kind of a really big deal, and I'm going to probably stretch it no matter what to try and get there because I really want to have a presence in front of not only all those potential listeners and those students, but also a lot of the great speakers like Dave Rubin will be there. Want to meet him. John Mackey will be there. Yeah, Mr. Mackey. A few other people, Steve Forbes. So it really would be a great event to go to, and I could get a lot of great interviews. So if you would help me out, that would be great. All right, thanks for joining us here on this episode of We Are Libertarians, and we will see you next week.
Later.
Thank you for listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Get our other shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.